much, everyone. There are a lot of people here I haven't seen before, so particularly welcome. And I'd be interested to know sometime, perhaps in the bar afterwards, where exactly you saw the advertisements for this, so I know where to advertise in future. Okay, I'm Marianne Talbot. I'm Director of Studies in Philosophy for the University's Department for Continuing Education. This is our building. And we run a thriving philosophy programme. You'll see at the back we've put out some leaflets and so on, which will give you an idea of what we've got. And I'll say a little something about the Philosophical Society and give you its website at the end. Just to say a bit about the programme for this evening, it is 3 hours, and both Stephen and I are thinking we're both completely mad to have said 3 hours. So we're going to have a break in the middle. We'll go till 8:20 and then have a 20-minute break, and then come back until 10 o'clock. So you will get your 3 hours minus 20 minutes, but the bar will be open, and do go and buy yourself a drink in the meantime. Stephen's now going to introduce himself, then I'm going to talk for 10, 15 minutes, then Stephen will talk for 10, 15 minutes, and then when we're properly at loggerheads with each other, we can bring you in. And just before we start, I'd like to say that we've actually got a very large audience here, an international audience from Second Life. Those of you who know anything about virtual worlds will know that you can attend lectures in the form of your avatar. There are quite a few people who are attending in the form of their avatar, and I'll say hello to them right now. So hello to the people in Second Life, and Dave will be asking questions on their behalf. So if you think that Dave is asking rather a lot of questions and that I'm being a bit unfair, he's actually representing quite a large number of people in Second Life. Okay, over to you, Stephen.
Hello, so I'm Stephen Law, and I am I'm a philosopher by profession. I teach philosophy at Heathrop College, University of London, and I edit, surprising. And I edit a journal for the Royal Institute of Philosophy called Think, which is aimed at the general public. So if you're interested in philosophy, you might like to have a look at the CUP, Cambridge University Press, webpage on that, possibly take out a subscription. I've written a number of philosophy books, but the reason I'm here today is that I'm the provost or head of the Centre for Inquiry in the UK, which is a new organisation. We are looking at applying science and reason to the big questions, religious questions, questions about the paranormal and parapsychological. We're looking at big contemporary social ethical problems, and we're looking at what is and isn't good science. On April the 25th, Saturday, we've got a big one-day event with Mary Warnock and Simon Singh and myself and Jack Cohen looking at science and religion. So if you enjoy it today, you might be interested in coming along to that event. We have lots of other events going on, so please check the CFI UK website, www.cfiuk.org. I'll tell you later, it'll also be on the screen. Okay. So, without more ado, I'm going to hand over to Marianne, who's going to tell us why Richard Dawkins' book is really excellent, I think.
Yeah, I think you got that wrong. I see there are a lot of people standing at the back. If you'd like to come forward, there are quite a lot of seats at the front here. We'll just wait for people to come and sit down. Okay. Right. Well, Stephen and I have talked about these issues on several occasions just between the two of us. And when I suggested that he might like to talk about this, he rather jumped at it. So I think we're going to enjoy this ourselves. Okay. Just quickly, would you move further back so you don't obscure my words? Okay. Those of you who will have read the book, and I assume that's at least some of you here, will know that it starts off with the God hypothesis. And this is it. I'll read it out because I'll need to do that for the Second Lifers. There's a superhuman, supernatural intelligence that deliberately designed and created the universe and everything in it, including us. That's the God hypothesis, the hypothesis that God exists. I'm going to be arguing against Dawkins because I need to make a few caveats in that first, because I will be arguing from my own position and not from a position of an apologist for any particular religion. I don't actually believe that God created the physical universe, though I do believe he created us, and in particular our minds. Importantly, I hold no brief for any particular religion, so I'm not going to engage with the arguments that Dawkins makes against miracles and that sort of thing, because, I'm happily talk about it, but that's not where I'm coming from. I come from the view that God exists and that he created us and our minds. He created us in his own image, which is as a rational, loving God. Okay, that's where I'm coming from. Dawkins' argument for the God hypothesis can be encapsulated in just two claims. Firstly, that the God hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis. Secondly, that the truth of it is highly improbable. I mean, basically, the book boils down to those two claims and all his arguments in support of these two claims. He says that the God hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis because it's either true or false, and it's made so by a scientific fact. And he also says that the universe with a God in it is very different from a universe with a God without a God in it. So that's why the God hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis. Then he says that it's highly improbable because the postulation of God, says Dawkins, explains nothing. And without an explanatory role, God is redundant. And if he's redundant, if he has no explanatory role, then there's no reason whatsoever to think he exists. Okay, I think Dawkins' argument, stripped to its basics in that way, is a good one. In that if the premises are true, then the conclusion is also true. And that's all we can ever ask of an argument, is that it preserves truth. If the premises are true, the conclusion are true. The conclusion is true, rather. So I'm not going to be questioning the validity of Dawkins' argument, but I am going to look at his premises. And I'll start with the claim that the God hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis. Firstly, again, I want to put up what Dawkins is right about. I think he's right to claim that the God hypothesis is either true or false, and that it's made so by a fact. Now, Dawkins says scientific fact, and you'll see I'll question that in a minute, but I absolutely accept that the God's hypothesis is either true or false, and that it's made so by a fact. The fact that God exists, or doesn't, as the case may be. I also agree with him that the universe with a God in it is very different from a universe without a God in it. And that, of course, if you're going to have a scientific hypothesis, is a necessary condition of a scientific hypothesis. If you say something that doesn't make a difference, then what have you got to test? So, I also think, however, that satisfaction of these conditions doesn't suffice to show that a hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis. Here are some other hypotheses that satisfy these conditions. Now, this is where having 15 minutes is really frustrating, because I know that there will be quite a lot of people in this room who won't know what I mean when I say the universe is as Berkeley claimed it to be. Bishop Berkeley had a view of the universe that was completely other than the view, the naive realist view, and I don't mean naive pejoratively, but the idea, he believed that the universe was idealistic, that it literally, to be is to be perceived. Now, if you take the two hypotheses, that the universe is as Berkeley believed it to be, and the universe is as Locke believed it to be, now both of those hypotheses are such that they're made true by facts. Both of them are such that the universe would be very different if it was true, but there's no way that this hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis. It's a philosophical hypothesis. It can only be tested by reason and argument, not by observation and experimentation. And here's another one. Utilitarianism hypothesizes that the right action is the action that produces the greatest happiness to the greatest number. Well, Kant would disagree with that. Kant believes that the right action is the one that accords with the moral law. Once again, we have if that's true, it's made true by facts about the greatest happiness to the greatest number. But it's if it's false, it's also made true by a fact, the fact that morality isn't like that. But this hypothesis isn't a scientific hypothesis either. Again, it's a philosophical one. And here's one, a particularly interesting one to scientists. The future will always be like the past. You can't do science without assuming that hypothesis. You can't do science without assuming that the future will be like the past, because the uniformity of nature, as Hume once showed us, is a sine qua non for science. You cannot do science without it. But science will never be able to say whether it's true or false, because its truth or falsehood is not a matter of observation or experiment. So the fact that a hypothesis is made true by facts, made true or false by facts, and the fact that it's suggests that the universe is one way rather than another, is not enough to make it a scientific hypothesis. So all those hypotheses satisfy Dawkins' condition. None of them is a scientific hypothesis, because none of them is such that its truth or falsehood can be established by observation and experimentation. And I want to just point out that this isn't a case of noma. And Dawkins seems to think that anyone who claims that the God hypothesis isn't a scientific hypothesis will do so on the grounds that religion and science have two different domains, if you like, that they're non-overlapping magisteria. I'm not claiming that. I'm claiming that there are hypotheses that are not scientific, but I'm not doing it so on the grounds that the domains of science and religion don't overlap. Okay, so the fact that I've shown there can be hypotheses that are not scientific doesn't mean that I've shown the God hypothesis isn't scientific, of course. So now I need to look at that. So is the God hypothesis a scientific hypothesis or not? Well, could it be established by observation and experiment? Well, Dawkins says, of course it's a scientific hypothesis, because if God wanted to, he could reveal himself. Well, I agree with that. I think he could reveal himself, but why would he? I mean, if you know anything about the view of what God is, then what God is somebody who demands faith of you, because the God I understand is the God of love, and he wants me... Oops, sorry.
It's okay.
I've got to remember, I'm talking to the Second Life people as well. And he wants me to exercise my free will in the direction of the right rather than the wrong. But why would I do that out of my own free will if he came down and told me I should? So God could reveal himself, but why would he? But anyway, I'm not expecting those of you who don't agree with me already to believe that, so let's have a look at another argument. Now, here we have another problem with the shortness of the introduction. I believe that if the truth of a theory called eliminativism could be demonstrated by science, I'll tell you a bit about what it is in a minute, then I would accept this as scientific evidence for the non-existence of God. Okay? So in a way, I am agreeing with Dawkins that the God hypothesis is a scientific hypothesis, because I think that if it could be shown that eliminativism is true, then science would have, then science would have demonstrated the falsity of the God hypothesis. But I'm not convinced, and I'll say more in a minute, about that eliminativism could be shown to be true by science. Eliminativism, by the way, is the idea that we are going to have to eliminate as redundant all our mental states. The idea that we don't act for reasons, we don't make choices, we don't have desires, beliefs. If any of you know what hard determinism is, eliminativism isn't the same thing as hard determinism, but it entails it. So if science could show that there are no reasons for acting, no free choices, then I accept that science would have shown that the God hypothesis is false. So, to that extent, I'm agreeing with Dawkins that the God hypothesis is a scientific one. But at the moment, given that I don't believe that it'll show eliminativism is true or false, I'm going to say that the jury's out on that. But I want to look at the second premise, the claim. The second premise, if you remember, was, just quickly, the truth of the God hypothesis is highly improbable. And the reason for that is because the postulation of God explains nothing, and without an explanatory role, God is redundant. In other words, there's no reason to think he exists. Okay, so if you have a theoretical entity is something that you postulate within a theory. So you have a theory that is being used to explain something, and you say it's sickness in cows. And you think, well, what's causing this? Why are these cows getting sick? And you think, I know, if it's magic, if there are magic spells and there are witches, then that would explain why the cows are getting sick. So here you have a hypothesis that magic exists, and you've got theoretical entities, witches and magic spells. So you're postulating these theoretical entities to explain an observable phenomenon. Now, God is often used as a theoretical entity. He's postulated an explanation of the beauty of the universe. You know, isn't it wonderful, therefore God? Okay, we couldn't explain anything were it not for postulating God. So the claim is that God's a theoretical entity, but we can explain everything he's postulated to explain in other ways, and what's more simply, therefore God is redundant. So these are the two questions that I need to ask about that premise. Well, firstly, I'll just say some people have personal experience of God. To them, he isn't a theoretical entity, or at least he's not only a theoretical entity. I believe I have personal experience of God. I also am well aware of all the other possible explanations of my belief that I have a personal experience of God, so I wouldn't dream of putting that up to you as reason to believe anything. But I would like to just say that Bertrand Russell wanted very much to be a behaviorist early in last century, but he tried very hard to convince himself that qualia, in other words, redness and blueness and pain and sensations, don't exist. But he says he couldn't convince himself of it, so he couldn't be a behaviorist. In the same way, I actually couldn't convince myself that God didn't exist. But as I said, I'm not going to convince you on that ground, so let's move on. Let's assume that there's no reason for believing in God other than that he plays an explanatory role within a theory. So if we're assuming that for the sake of argument, now we've got to look at is whether he's been made redundant. Well, first of all, I should go back to the book. Dawkins goes through a number of things that God has been postulated to explain and shows that he isn't necessary to explain. I mean, I completely accept what Dawkins says about the watchtower wonders of nature. I've forgotten how you pronounce that thing. What is it?
I don't know.
The little basilisk. Anyway, you know, you get your watchtower through the door from the Jehovah's Witness, and they say, you know, here's this wonderful thing that couldn't possibly have come about by chance, therefore God must exist. Dawkins is absolutely right. God is not the only alternative to chance. Natural selection is the best alternative to chance that you get there. Therefore,
the bacterial flagellum.
That's it. That's the one.
No, I know.
Or all other wonders of nature that, I mean, it doesn't really matter what it is.
Only God can make a bacterial flagellum.
Yeah, exactly. Because it couldn't have come about by chance. Yeah. But of course, God and chance are not the only two alternatives. Natural selection is the other one. Okay, I completely accept, and I also accept his arguments for the anthropic principle about how did life come about to be here, etc. All these, I think, are good arguments, and they're worth having. But I think if eliminativism is true, then there's nothing that God is needed to explain. I completely accept that God's a theoretical entity in that way. So if eliminativism is true, then there's no meaning, there's no truth, there's no reason, there's no right, and there's no wrong. Just quickly show you why that's so. Beliefs have content. Beliefs and the sentences that express them are the only things that exist that are true or false. If you eliminate beliefs, then you eliminate content, you eliminate meaning. You also eliminate truth and falsehood. You also eliminate reasons. And in doing that, you eliminate free will, free choice. So there's no right nor wrong either, because if there's no free will, there's no right or wrong. I think if eliminativism is true, and this really is a universe where there's no meaning, no right or wrong, no truth or falsehood, and science can show that, I think if it's true, never mind if science can show it, but then God will have been shown to be redundant. I accept that. But I also think we're a million miles from establishing that eliminativism is true. I think the other thing is, if all these things could be reduced to things visible to science, so if you could show that there is no more to right or wrong than the greatest happiness of the greatest number, and of course that is visible to science, then again, science might be able to explain them all. But I also think we're a million miles from reducing such things to things that are visible to science. So I actually think it's highly improbable that eliminativism will ever be shown to be true by science, just as improbable that we're ever going to reduce these things to something visible to science, and for that reason I think the God hypothesis has a fighting chance of being true, even if it does seem improbable to those of us who have faith in the ability of science one day to explain everything. In other words, I don't think Dawkins' book has shown that the God hypothesis is highly improbable. Thank you. I'm sorry, I've gone over my time.
No, I probably would have thought. Do you know what? Well, thank you very much. I think we should have a few questions now, actually, rather than me just clamming on.
Well, tell you what, why don't you put your...
I'll fiddle around over there.
And I'll answer.
Yeah, because I think your ideas about God are a little bit unusual, and people may want to ask you some clarificatory questions, is it, I guess?
More than happy to answer. There's one right there.
Why do you think that it's a he rather than a she?
Oh,
that's
true. Sorry, I think that's a non-question, because I don't think God is either male or female. I don't think God is physically embodied. I don't think he has a body. I don't think he has X or Y chromosomes. And so it would do, but I think it sounds so much like an animal and
an object.
Yeah.
The direct experience you have of it, or he or she, that's...
of him or her. Of him, not of he.
Should we have another question?
Could you just restate what you think eliminativism is?
Eliminativism is... Eliminativism is the view that when we postulate beliefs, desires, hopes, fears, intentions, etc., in our attempts to explain others' behaviours, we're postulating our minds as theoretical entities, and that the theory in which we postulate the existence of our minds is actually false. Neurophysiology will come and show us that we have no beliefs, no desires, no intentions, etc., that all we have inside our head are physical states. It's a very... Actually, the arguments for the theory are actually much better than you might think. I spent quite a long time looking at eliminativism, and I find it quite convincing at times. Then I come to my senses.
Let's suppose that the scientists who are studying the neural cognates of neural correlates of cognition make advances in the future, and they're able to identify neural networks in your brain, which, by the administration of some naturally occurring chemical in the brain, could cause you to cease believing in God. In other words, suggesting that your belief in God is caused by a set of neural connections, which is determined by some kind of chemical action. If they did that experiment on you and you were made to lose your belief whenever a certain chemical was administered in your brain, would you continue to believe in God afterward?
Well, no, because by definition, no. Because you've told me of a situation where I would have been caused not to believe in God. So no, of course I could still believe in God.
After the molecules go away that suppress that neural network.
What the experiment had done and shown had caused me to believe temporarily that I didn't believe in God, but that the belief that I didn't believe in God was false, not my belief in God.
What has propelled you to this sort of strange dualism in which you seem to propound the sort of eternal existence of the material universe, and yet
I think you should just clarify, because you did say...
That seemed to be the implication, anyway.
I didn't believe that God had created the physical universe. I believe the physical universe came into existence with the Big Bang.
That the corollary of that is surely that our bodies are also,
physical.
Yes, and therefore not created by God.
Yep.
And that's what I call your dualism, because you assert that the mind is created by God.
Yep.
This is a weird sort of combination,
it
seems.
It is.
I mean, it's original.
But sorry, can I interrupt you a second, because we're going to get far away from the topic. You asked me how I came to this. The answer is, I started trying to finish my DPhil, and as I was doing PhD, and as I was doing it, I was trying to show that we are nothing more than computers, that there's nothing more to us than physical beings who work syntactically. The more, of course, if you do that, you have to try and look at the objections to your own view. The more I looked at the objections to my own view, the more I thought, I'm wrong. Actually, we are more than computers. And I started to believe in God. Aged, I don't know how old I was, 30-ish. I'm one of those dreadful people who wants to say, I used to be an atheist, but I'm no longer. And it's true. So that's how I came to this view, by a lot of hard philosophical thinking, which I can't really go into in the 2 minutes I've got left.
No, that's a bit snappy. We're not computers, therefore God exists. Is a bit. I'm sure it's.
No, I did. Say, no, hang on. I did say. If you let me finish, I did say that I was looking at the objections to the view that we're not computers, and the more I looked at them, the more I thought these are much stronger than I thought they were. In fact, they are strong enough that I'm going to change my view. That's how I came to it. Not. Come on.
All right.
So unfair. Go on.
All right. Right. Okay. Well, I'm going to do my best to stick to my 15 minutes. I wasn't having a go at you. No, I'm just saying. I've attempted to put a few thoughts together, and my hope is I can do it in 15 minutes, but if I run slightly over, I apologise. So here are a few thoughts for you. Make sure I can make this work. No, I can't. Okay, now I know which button to press. Dawkins, as we've already seen, and Marianne has explained this, is rather dismissive of non-scientific approaches to the God question. It is, he thinks, a scientific question to be answered by science, if at all. And actually, I agree with Marianne that that's not quite right, actually. It seems to me that Dawkins has made an error here. He's producing a hostage to fortune. He's making concessions which he really doesn't need to make, and in fact he would be well advised not to make. So I'm just going to point out a couple of reasons why, the first of which is much the same as Marianne's point a minute ago. There do appear to be questions that science can't answer. Moral questions, we've already seen, appear to be questions science can't answer. What makes things right or wrong? Why is killing wrong? What is the explanation, the justification for the wrongness? Hume famously points out that no matter how many facts you accumulate of the is type, scientific facts or claims about how things are, they will never allow you to deduce, by means of a rational argument, a conclusion about what you ought or ought not to do. You can't, to quote the slogan, get an ought out of an is. And so we immediately come up against a class of questions which it seems science is helpless to answer. We need to go somewhere else if we're going to supply the answers to those kind of questions. Another question which it seems science can't answer is, why is there anything at all? The reason why science can't answer that on the face of it, is that on the leading theories of scientific explanation, take Hempel's covering law model of scientific explanation. To provide a scientific explanation is to show that a particular event falls under a law of nature, or a particular law is subsumed by some greater law. But then it follows that you cannot explain the most basic laws of all. They will necessarily be beyond the ability of science to explain. And other accounts of how scientific explanation work run into similar problems. So it looks as if there are inevitably going to be some questions that science is not going to be able to answer, and Marianne produced some other famous examples too. So we've got plenty of examples now, counterexamples. It is with these questions, of course, that where science appears to run out of steam, that philosophy and religion quickly step in. If you ask a religious person these kind of questions, they'll say, well, things are right or wrong because God says so, for example. And why is there anything at all? Well, because God created it. God provides a very neat solution, at first sight, anyway, to these kind of questions. Philosophy, too, addresses them, but in a slightly different way. How? Well, one of the things it does is it does conceptual engineering, to borrow a phrase from the philosopher Simon Blackburn, professor of philosophy at Cambridge, Trinity. He was asked, what's philosophy? And he suggested that it is, at least in part, conceptual engineering. We are working with concepts and seeing how they link together, how one concept might entail another, how certain concepts might involve internal conflicts or contradictions and so on. And so, if that's true, you can see how potentially, at least, a purely philosophical, non-scientific argument could be constructed against the God hypothesis. If you could show that the hypothesis contains some kind of internal conceptual problem, if there's a contradiction involved in there some way, then you can show that the God hypothesis is nonsensical, in which case science doesn't need to show that it's false, and indeed can't show it's false because it's incapable of being false or true. It doesn't make sense. So this would be a far more radical attack on the God hypothesis. A philosophical attack of that sort would be potentially far more devastating. And it is possible that such an attack can be mounted. I think it can, actually, and maybe we'll talk about that later on. So we've looked at one possibility for how philosophy might produce a non-scientific refutation of the God hypothesis. There's one possibility. Dawkins certainly can't rule it out a priori. It's on the table. Could be true. Another way in which we might bypass science is this. Science is a comparatively recent invention, it seems to me. You can argue about exactly what science is, but it seems to me that for science, you need a pretty sophisticated methodology. Science, as we understand it, is something fairly sophisticated and probably not more than a few hundred years old. When I prove to you that there's no cat down my shirt, I might prove it to Marianne by now wandering over there and getting her to give me a good feel without actually lifting my shirt up. She could thereby establish there ain't no cat under my shirt. Would Marianne be doing science at this point? It seems to me that that's the last thing you could call it. And yet she would have straightforwardly falsified, it seems to me, proof beyond reasonable doubt, that there ain't no cat up my shirt. It's always possible that there is some micro cat hidden under an armpit or something. But
we'll
check later. Okay. So it seems to me that you can straightforwardly, empirically falsify certain hypotheses without doing any science at all. And indeed, people were doing that long before science was invented, actually. So this raises another possibility. Perhaps we could show that the God hypothesis is false, not by doing science, but just by perhaps pointing out some patently obvious facts. Maybe we could do that. That wouldn't be a scientific refutation. It's a possibility. We can't rule this out, it seems to me, a priori. So it seems to me there are a number of options here which Dawkins has failed to rule out as far as a non-scientific refutation of the God hypothesis is concerned. I've given you a couple of examples. Now, what I want to do, I'm doing okay for time actually, what I want to do now is sketch out very briefly, just to wind some of you up, a possible argument of that kind. Let's look at the God hypothesis and see whether we could refute it, not by doing science, but just by looking out the window. Maybe we could. The problem is, that I have in mind, is the evidential problem of evil. Now, at this point, I have to make a slight qualification. The God hypothesis, as Dawkins defines it, is a very thin hypothesis, and he doesn't attribute goodness, for example, to God. Well, I'm going to work with a slightly richer conception of God, the kind of concept of God that most Jews and Christians and Muslims, for example, sign up to, if they're remotely orthodox, and that is that God is the creator of the universe and that he is supremely benevolent and good. God is love. Let's run with that hypothesis. The problem that you immediately run into is that there's just an enormous amount of suffering in the world, and there's an enormous amount of moral depravity in the world. And it's a very good question why a supremely powerful and good and loving creator would allow quite so much pain and anguish and suffering. Yes, there's a lot of good stuff, no doubt about it, but boy, there really is a lot of bad stuff. Could the sheer quantity of bad stuff provide us with pretty good evidence that there ain't no God? Well, it seems to me it does. I mean, it just is fantastically good evidence that there is no God. I know it doesn't strike everyone like that. We'll look at that suggestion, that problem, perhaps in a minute. Hundreds of millions of years of animal suffering, for example, before human beings even made an appearance on the face of the earth, there were mass extinction events, the second to last of which wipes 95% of all species from the face of the earth, including, you know, the dinosaurs. Quite literally unimaginable quantities of pain and suffering unleashed on sentient creatures over hundreds of millions of years before we even showed up. Why? What could possibly be the explanation for that if this universe was created by an all-powerful and supremely benevolent creator? It just doesn't make sense. And then, of course, when we make an appearance, we find tsunamis, cancer, the Holocaust, Black Death, hemorrhoids. The pain goes on and on. And then there's moral depravity and so on. Now, you may argue, and many people do, that God would inevitably have to put some pain and suffering in the world for the sake of greater goods. And perhaps you can explain some of it in that way. I'm not running, though, with what's known as the logical problem of evil, which is the existence of God is logically incompatible with any pain or suffering at all. So if there's even a tiny, weeny bit, God doesn't exist. I'm not running that argument. That's the one that theists love to refute because it's so easy to refute. I'm running the other one, the evidential problem of evil. That's the problem of explaining why there is such enormous, enormous amount of pain and horror and suffering unleashed on humanity and the sentient inhabitants of this planet on a daily basis. Why on earth is there so much, is the puzzle. Now, Dawkins doesn't consider the evidential problem of evil much of an argument. He's rather dismissive of it, and he runs his own argument instead, which is a sort of argument from explanatory superfluity, if you like. The God hypothesis is an unnecessary add-on. It's not required. It seems to me that the evidential argument is actually far more devastating, and he underestimates its power. One of the reasons, maybe, why he underestimates its power is it's not really scientific. The thing about evil is it's very difficult to quantify, isn't it? How do you measure it, suffering, pain? I mean, you know, you can't kind of put a slide rule up against it or do some science with it very easily. It's kind of impressionistic, subjective even. And for that reason, maybe it's not quite scientific enough. We want some hard data, we want some numbers, some figures, something quantifiable. So that may be one reason why. And of course, because it is kind of impressionistic and hard to measure these things, there is the possibility that the theist will, you know, with a little bit of sleight of hand, a little explanation here, a little quick step there, they might be able to wriggle out of the objection. I'm going to suggest that really there's no way that they can wriggle out of this objection. It's just too good an objection to theism. So, the problem really is this. There are very few arguments for a specifically good God, although Marianne actually has some. mostly you get, well, you know, only God can make a bacterial flagellum or something like that. But that's not an argument for a good God, that's just an argument for some intelligence. I mean, why jump to the conclusion that it's all good rather than, say, all evil? No reason at all. No justification whatsoever for supposing that that's evidence for the Judeo-Christian God. None at all. There's also the problem of explaining why there's so much evil. There are those explanations of why there's so much evil which appeal to things like free will. Well, God had to give us free will in order to allow us to become noble and good beings and to do good of our own free will. That's a very great good. You can only have that good in your creation if you give us free will, but the downside of free will is that we sometimes freely choose to do bad things, and that's why there's war and suffering and pain and so on. So there's that kind of theodicy. Or there's the character-building theodicy. There's a lot of pain and suffering, but it's you know, for your own good. It makes you a better person. People get ill afterwards. They don't necessarily regret it. They don't regret the pain. They say, you know what, that was a good thing. It's helped me grow and develop morally and spiritually and so on. So we could run a sort of John Hick-type character-building theodicy. There are all sorts of explanations. If you don't find those plausible, you can always play the mystery card and say, you know what, Mr. Clever Dick philosopher, you know, who are you to think that you can understand the mind of God? This is, after all, a being of infinite knowledge and wisdom and intelligence. Inevitably, much of his divine plan is going to be beyond your ken, and so the mere fact that you can't understand it all is really no evidence at all against the hypothesis. You can play the mystery card. So those are the ways in which theists typically try and deal with what looks to be overwhelming empirical evidence against what they believe. But now let me run a different hypothesis by you, the evil God hypothesis. Suppose there's no good God, there's a creator, he's all-powerful, he's supremely evil, he is supremely malignant, his cruelty knows no bounds. How sensible a hypothesis is that? Well, it's completely ridiculous, isn't it? Because there's way too much good in the world. This is the evidential problem of good. Why would such a being create love and laughter and rainbows? He'd be torturing us for all eternity with a red hot poker, surely. But no, we get beautiful children to love us, who we can love unconditionally in return. Evil God hates love. Why on earth would he introduce these little bundles of joy into his universe? Why would he give some of us fantastic wealth and good fortune? Why would David Beckham get that multi-billion pound contract with and that new Ferrari? And, you know, why would he do that? It makes no sense if he's supreme. He'd be torturing David Beckham with a red hot poker for all eternity. But no, he gets a Bentley. See, it's overwhelming evidence against the evil God hypothesis. And I could go on, obviously. In response, why is there so much beauty in the world? An evil God would want us to, hate the environment in which we live. It should be painful and horrible and disgusting. Why would he give us healthy bodies so we can frolic in the sunshine? Why would he do that? He'd give us horrible, painful, arthritic bodies instead. Well, what about this? The free will theodicy. Evil God could have made us do evil of our own volition. But that wouldn't really be evil. It's only evil if you choose to do it of your own free will, right? Otherwise, you're just puppet beings. So in order to maximise the amount of evil that there is in the universe, God had to create us free. As a result of our being free, Mother Teresa goes around being nice to people, and that is the downside from evil God's point of view, of us being given free will. But nevertheless, you know, we are generally weak and selfish beings, and when we think we can get away with it, we will be horrible to each other. And so that's why this free will and the resulting pain and suffering, sorry, good stuff, exists. So I can run a free will, it's just the mirror of theodicy, of the standard Christian theodicy. You are laughing at it, notice, some of you. What about the flipping the character building theodicy, the character destroying theodicy? This is the worst of all possible worlds. Why do we sometimes get some beauty in the world in order to make our appreciation of the ugliness and dreariness of day-to-day life all the more acute? That's why. Why would an evil God give us beautiful children to love so that we will worry about them? I mean, the kind of pain and anguish that parents feel is not available to an evil God unless he gives us something that we love unconditionally, and then so that we can worry about it. Why does he give us beautiful, healthy young bodies, yeah, for about 10 or 15 years, and then slowly and inexorably he pulls it away? It is so much more painful to have something great and lose it than never to have had it at all. And then there's the sword of Damocles of cancer or being hit by a bus hanging over you in the meantime, making you squirm in other ways. Why does David Beckham get the new Ferrari to make the rest of you feel bad? That's why, and it works. I'm just running the standard Christian theodicies, but I'm just turning them around. And if you don't like them, I'll play the mystery card. Who are you, you clever dicks, to think that you could understand the mind of a supremely evil being who is supremely intelligent and knowledgeable? This is inevitably going to be beyond your understanding. This really is the worst of all possible worlds. You just don't understand how. So, some humility, for goodness sake. I'm just turning around the standard explanations, and they're funny, they're pathetic, they're not convincing at all. It seems to me that exactly the same is true of the standard theodicies. They are a joke to anyone who's not kind of somehow been strangely seduced by this hypothesis. It is baffling to me why it is that people can't just open their eyes and see that it's patently obvious that, well, that there ain't no evil God. You need only look out the window to see there is no evil God. You don't need science to know there's no evil God. But you don't need science to know that there's no good God either, and for pretty much exactly the same reasons. It's not... You can use science if you like. I mean, be my guest, I'm not ruling it out. But you don't need science. It's not required in order to show that the hypothesis is frankly ridiculous. I mean, it's just straightforwardly empirically falsified, the good God hypothesis. There may be some intelligence behind the universe, but it clearly ain't all-powerful and supremely evil. It's equally clear that it ain't all-powerful and supremely good either, seems to me. I'm going on too long. I'm going to go very quickly now. Sorry. So I think we can show there ain't no God fairly quickly, but it may not be Marianne's God, which is going to be the complication. Dennis Turner, famous theologian, says, I think you've got to find a way of asking certain kind of question if you're going to be a proper card-carrying atheist. I think one begins to be a theist when one realises that there's a certain kind of question which gets swept off the agenda, and that question is, why is there anything at all? Atheists just don't take that question seriously. Well, of course they do. I mean, I've spent half my career thinking about those kind of questions, and I'm an atheist. We take it very seriously indeed. Just because we take it seriously and we acknowledge that we can't answer it, though, doesn't mean that we have to acknowledge that the God hypothesis might then be true. Suppose Sherlock Holmes is having a bad day and he can't figure out who did it. Does it follow that he can't rule out certain suspects? Of course he can. The butler definitely didn't do it because he was in the room with Sherlock Holmes at the time. Has a cast iron alibi. In the same way, it may be that either I can't explain why the universe exists, but I can be jolly confident it wasn't created by an all-powerful and supremely evil deity. I mean, there's just overwhelming evidence against that hypothesis, right? And of course you all agree that there is. But then you have to agree that it could at least be possible that there is overwhelming evidence against the suggestion that it was created by an all-powerful and all-good deity. At the very least, you have to acknowledge that is a possibility. So we atheists do take the question seriously. Just because we acknowledge it doesn't mean that we are obliged to agree with the theist that their answer could be true. We're not. So it seems to me that partially Dawkins, against Dawkins, it maybe we don't need science to show there's no God. It may just be that you need to look out the window for 5 minutes to know that there's no God. Alistair McGrath, in his book, The Dawkins Delusion, says, there can be no question of scientific proof of ultimate questions. Either we cannot answer them or we must answer them on grounds other than the sciences. Well, it seems to me there could be proof from science, but actually you don't need a scientific proof. There's just a bog-standard proof beyond reasonable doubt right here. We've just looked at it. We have proved beyond reasonable doubt that there ain't no God of the sort that Jews and Christians and Muslims believe in. I just don't understand why Alistair McGrath insists that it must be beyond science or an empirical study to determine whether, you know, the answer to that question. We can prove beyond reasonable doubt that there is no evil God, so why not a good God, is my question. And now you must buy my books and join CFR UK. So that's it. I went a bit long, didn't I? Sorry. I can have to be there the whole time now.
Would you people like to come? There are quite a lot of people standing at the back. Why don't you come and sit down? There are plenty of seats at the front or in the middle. I'm going to extend to Stephen the same courtesy he did to me. Questions of clarification for Stephen.
Yes.
As far as I'm aware, a belief in God doesn't necessarily preclude a belief in what people might call the devil or Satan. And if the devil or Satan exists and God is an all-loving God, then God has to allow Satan to do what Satan wants to do, which is called evil in the world.
Why does he?
I wonder how... Well, if he's a loving God, then a loving God will love even Satan.
So it doesn't mean he has to let him do what he wants.
No.
Well, that's what Satan does. Satan is...
Well, why doesn't God stop him? He's omnipotent.
Satan is all-loving. And God allows each person to have its own free will, which includes Satan.
But, well, look, if I'm in charge of a nursery and I've got an assistant who loves torturing the kids with a red-hot poker, I am certainly not going to respect their freedom to carry on doing that. Absolutely not. I would step in and prevent it, had I the power to do that. Similarly, to say, well, God, you know, let Satan torture us with a red-hot poker, and he has to do that because, you know, he has to acknowledge Satan's free will. I mean... Obviously he doesn't. It's just obvious that he doesn't have to do that. He could prevent it, and he should prevent it. And if I don't prevent my assistant from torturing those kids, I will be locked up and sent to prison and held morally responsible and rightly be considered a terrible, terrible person. Certainly not supremely good. And I just think God should be held to the same standard.
But I'm not viewing that with your own view of what love is.
Yes,
not
I could.
Totally,
and yes, and you are failing. Well, you know, we could. There's a kind of semantic move where you say, well, you have to understand that good, when applied to God, doesn't mean what it means when we apply it to humans, because he's like a whole different category of fish. And so that's why he allows the devil to torture us with a red hot poker or whatever it is. But of course, you can make that move with the evil God hypothesis. You can say, why does an evil God allow rainbows and ice cream? Well, you've got to understand that evil means something different when applied to this other category of being, that it means when it's applied to beings like you and I. And so it's just your misunderstanding or failure to grasp what evil means when applied to divinities that explains your inability to grasp why God would do these things. That's exactly the same explanation. It's clearly ridiculous when applied to the evil God hypothesis, and it seems to me no less ridiculous when applied to the good God hypothesis. The real mystery is why anyone would take it seriously, because of course this is not, you know, this is a standard move amongst theists, and they do take it seriously. I don't know why.
There's some second round questions. Just
question for Second Life.
Okay.
It says here, could I ask Stephen how he arrived at the conclusion that the amount of evidential evil is sufficient to disqualify the possibility of God? It seems to me that it's unclear how much evidential evil is necessary for this.
Yeah, and that is the Dawkins worry about the evidential argument. And that is the move that one of the moves that philosophers like Plantinga make in order to try and deal with the evidence. You can't measure it, so you can't use it. But you don't say that about the evil God hypothesis and the amount of good. You don't need to measure it. It's perfectly obvious that there's just so much good in the world that this can't possibly be the creation of a supremely evil being. And for somebody to say, but hang on a minute, you know, there could be an evil God, and you know, maybe the amount of good, how do you measure good? How do you know that there's enough? That is just the mirror response. And clearly, it's a joke when used to defend belief in an evil God. It is a joke here, frankly. The fact that you cannot quantify it in these kind of ways, with that kind of precision, does not mean that we cannot run an extremely powerful evidential argument in just the same way as we can, and everyone agrees to this, run an extremely powerful evidential argument against the evil God hypothesis. If you can run it against one, you can run it against the other. Yes?
You talked about the question, why is there anything at all? And but I was surprised you didn't say the point, which always comes to me, is that God is something. Because if God is nothing, then God can create something.
Yeah.
So to use God as an explanation for why is there anything is not an answer at all, because it's just another thing that needs to be explained.
Yes. Well, there is that kind of regress problem, which Dawkins runs, of course. He's running a kind of regress problem. You appeal to this kind of complexity by appealing to that complex being, but then what accounts for his complexity? Yet another being, and so on. You produce a regress. You're really sweeping the problem under the carpet. The trouble is that theists, you know, are not fools, and they are ready for that. They'll say, well, when you hit God, you hit a necessary being. There has to be a necessary being. And that's why you can stop asking that question at that particular point. It no longer makes sense. Why is there something rather than nothing when it comes to a necessary being? There just has to be such a being. So they have their answers. I agree with you, though, that that's certainly a question which needs an answer.
But surely, I mean, if you say that the answer to... because there is something, there must be a creator, and that's necessary... then why do you go there? Why don't you just say the world exists so it's necessary?
Because it seems to them painfully obvious that it's not necessary that the universe exists, just intuitively. And most people will say, yeah, it's not. It's a contingent fact. Now, actually, this is really interesting. As a matter of fact, well, I recommend a book to you. Recommend a book called Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing by a philosopher called Bede Rundell, who's based at Trinity, Oxford. He says there just has to be something rather than nothing. It's inevitable. In fact, there are all sorts of puzzles, for example, about trying to envisage the very possibility of absolute nothing. I can think about there being nothing in this Coke can, an empty tract of space and for a time there's nothing in there, or somebody not thinking about anything for a while. But absolute nothing with a capital I and a capital N, can you really think about that? I always end up not thinking about anything, which is not the same thing as thinking about nothing in the required sense, see what I mean? So it's kind of puzzling, this notion of absolute nothing, which is the alternative to something. I personally have come round to the view that the question, why is there something rather than nothing, doesn't make sense. So it doesn't need an answer. But this is hugely complicated, and I'm not even going to start to get into that now because it's such a big can of worms. Yes.
We ought to...
we should be ping-ponging.
Yeah.
Yes.
Can I put a couple of cautionary remarks to you?
Okay.
In that case, that's a good moment to bring us back in, so we're all... Because yes, the idea is it throws open to you to ask both.
Both of you so far seem to move, which I want to do as well, move on to a third topic, because you're not really talking about Dawkins' main specialism.
I want to talk about transcendence, self-transcendence, the sort of thing you were hinting at with your "I'm not a computer." And you talk about character in a very negative way in the Christian learning context, you know, how you build character through suffering and things. But you've got to build character on something, so there are two sort of open questions there. I don't think Dawkins deals with those at all well in his book. He doesn't really answer those sort of questions. So I'm agreeing with you that there are big weaknesses in his approach to life, possibly. Not necessarily that God's always the answer, and I'm no doubt you will be able to have a very good positional character formation, for example.
Yeah. Do you want to say something about that?
I'm not sure I understand the question, to be honest. I do think that, I mean, Dawkins believes that there is no good or evil, that there is, that this universe is a hard deterministic, eliminativist universe. And I don't really understand how he squares that belief with his belief that science is wonderful and that hymns are worth singing and all that sort of thing. So, if that's what you mean about he doesn't seem to have a decent theory of character, is that what you mean?
Well, I'm talking to you too as well. I think Dawkins doesn't really talk about that, but you've mentioned in your last remark, and I'll let you carry on with it in a minute, but that you realise you weren't a computer.
Mm.
I happen to look at a lot of philosophers, more personalist, existential, transcendent type philosophers who look for a kind of openness to experience, I suppose. And that's not really common in Dawkins, and I'm not saying that the atheist can't develop his own strategy in that area, but it's a different area, but so far we haven't really talked about, you know, whether genes are a good hypothesis or any of the basic blocks
I talked about it. Well, I said that I think the theory of natural selection is a far better alternative to the theory of chance when it comes to the design of the natural universe. So I completely accept Dawkins on that. I believe in natural selection.
Biologically, doesn't work.
Sorry, you've had a go. Let's, Alan.
You've said, I think, that the God hypothesis is true or false in your view, and is made true or false by some kind of fact, but it's not a scientific kind of fact, not a matter of observation or experience. Would you like to say some more about what kind of fact it is that makes the God hypothesis true?
Well, it's whether God exists or not.
But in order for us not to think that's empty as an assertion that God exists, we have to have some idea what kind of fact makes it true or not. And I wasn't clear what kind of fact you envisage.
Okay. It's a little difficult to say, apart from to echo Stephen. I also go along with the idea that when I'm talking about God, I will use the traditional view of God as being omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, etc. I believe he's intelligent. I believe we were created in his image insofar as we...
What evidence is there for all these apparent propositions to say that they're not meaningless?
But they're clearly not meaningless. Your understanding is, as I said.
They would be meaningless if there were no substance in the notion of God, if there were nothing which can be for or against this subject, which is then supposed to have these attributes.
To be honest, Alan, I'm not sure I understand you. I here's a claim. There is a God. Okay. I believe that claim is made true or false, and that therefore what makes it true or false is a fact. I said I didn't agree with Dawkins that it was a scientific fact, actually. I said I'm not quite sure what a scientific fact is. The fact that I believe makes true that hypothesis, and that Stephen, I think, believes makes it false, or rather the non-existence of this fact, is that there is a God who is loving. Actually, I believe that God is that towards which we strive. He's love, truth, love, truth, peace, etc.
And the fact that we do strive towards things other than ourselves is acknowledged, and all the psychological facts that you're proposing, I wouldn't want to dispute. But the argument that there is something intelligible, definable, which is the subject of all these things you're saying, which are psychological facts, seems to me eminently debatable.
Well, I know it's debatable. We are debating it.
Of getting closer to God than that, it sounds to me empty. I mean, there is a good Christian tradition here, but that we see now as through a glass darkly and then face to face. Somehow, in the afterlife, we will know God. And that I can understand as a kind of non-scientific fact. But unless you're saying something like that, I don't understand what you're
saying. But I am saying something like
that's
that.
That's also the answer to suffering, by the way, which is what I wanted to say.
I'll tell you what, why don't we let Stephen answer your question by saying what fact he thinks, what non-existing fact makes false the God hypothesis.
Mary, is it possible to get rid of the writing that is swimming
across? Yes, can we pull the plug on me?
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah. Professional to the end.
That's evil
done. Yeah. Can we just pull the plug out?
We're just going to get a blackout. Go on.
Well, look, yes, that see, I said we can falsify the hypothesis, but is there actually a hypothesis there to falsify is the deeper question. And I suggested earlier that possibly we could make a case for saying the hypothesis is nonsensical to begin with, in which case you don't need to falsify it. In fact, you can't falsify it because there ain't nothing there to falsify. Now,
absolutely. If the problem of evil works, then the traditional idea of God is inconsistent.
Well, no, I think it's consistent. It's just a false hypothesis. But you could show that the hypothesis itself were somehow incoherent. And, well, you know, the standard thing you wheel out is, you know, could God make a stone that was so heavy he couldn't lift it? And then if you immediately see the puzzle, there seems to be some kind of contradiction involved, you see. Either he can or he can't, but if he can't, then he can.
So,
now, that I don't think is a particular... I think you can get around that, and if you talk to a sophisticated philosopher of religion like Richard Swinburne, he's got his neat little moves to deal with that kind of objection. But maybe that, well, here's another different worry. Suppose I tell you that I believe that there's a chair that exists outside of time and space. You probably say, what do you mean? I mean, the thing about a chair is that it's an arrangement of physical bits, you know, in space, which exists for a certain amount of time. I mean, how could there be a chair which exists outside of space and time? There has to be a certain spatial arrangement. What are you talking about, for goodness sake? It doesn't make any sense. Now, the idea that there could be a person that is outside of time and space, actually not all theists think that God is outside of time and space, but just for the sake of argument, let's work with that hypothesis. A person who is outside of time and space, can we make any more sense of that, frankly? The idea of a person, the idea of an agent, the idea of psychology, the idea of creator, design, you have a plan, you fulfill it. How these are temporal concepts. The idea of design, creation, they do not make sense outside of the... that the notion even... I'm not saying it doesn't. I'm just saying, prima facie, there's a bit of explaining to do.
I don't understand how you can say you don't understand the question, is there a God? Because it seems to me that we're all here, at least on the face of it, we're all here because we've come, because we have... We have a view. We either think there isn't a God or we think there is a God. Or we're open-minded, but I suspect that that's in the minority. If we think there isn't a God, we must have some idea of what it is that there isn't.
I'm not sure.
In other words, which descriptions aren't instantiated. Well, I disagree with you. I think that to the extent you think that the question is coherent and that there is an answer yes or no, then you think you understand the question.
One for you, Stephen. What happens to the nonsensicality argument if we assert that God is neither good nor evil,
that there is a God. He's neither good nor evil. He's put us here to evolve, to make ourselves better, to become the oneness that we all read elsewhere about, that we might become one day and so forth, but that we're on an evolutionary path at the moment. What happens to your nonsensicality argument?
Well, my nonsensicality argument still works, but my problem with evil argument doesn't. you're still hooking yourself to the notion of some kind of person who is outside of space and time, only now we're saying neither all good nor all evil. But the very notion of a person that exists outside of space and time, I have to say I find that as baffling as the idea of a chair that exists outside of space and time. But look, it may be... maybe
anthropomorphism, what you're preparing.
No, it's not. It's conceptual analysis. It's conceptual analysis. Analyse the concept of
the
chair.
We have to be a bit careful here of person, because we tend to think of persons as embodied. Yeah.
It's an analogy.
And of course, we're
save
not
my
thinking
chair
of God as embodied.
It's like a chair, and it's not like a chair.
I would like to take what you've just said, because I have an answer, as you know, what I take to be an answer to the problem of evil. I think the problem of evil is the most difficult problem for anyone who believes in God. I've had real trouble with the problem of evil, because I think it's... And how can there be a God who is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-benevolent, given how much evil there is in the world? That is a real problem. And I think it really does suggest that the whole idea of God may be inconsistent. The way I square that with myself is not in any of the ways that Stephen mentioned, but more in this way. I think that actually we are intended, that creation wasn't intended to be finished. I don't think God created the physical universe in the first place. What he did create is people like us who are capable of learning why there are earthquakes, why there are tsunamis, why there's disease, and what's more, capable of working out how to stop it. And I think that if we were to get our values right, we would be putting, for example, the tsunami in Asia, 3-4 years ago, killed 400,000 people, I think it was. Very interesting that we have no tsunami early warning systems in that part of the world. We have perfectly good tsunami warning systems in Hawaii. Why do we not have any there? Actually, if we had our values in the right place, and instead of building castles of straw by bankers, if we were actually thinking of how to cure cancer, how to put tsunami warning systems in, we would actually find that there would be much less evil in the world. I think that a large amount of the evil in the world is actually our fault. It's got nothing to do with God at all. You may want to come back on that, or you may want to...
Let's have another question. This gentleman.
I'm sort of one of these people who genuinely is open-minded about the existence of God, although I find myself more pulled towards Stephen than not. But establishing the possibility of a creator is one thing, but then assigning to that creator qualities is an entirely different thing. Now, to sort of just dig into that a little bit, how does anybody like you, Marion, decide that he's made us in his image when we hardly understand ourselves and have got no idea of what he is like? And can you use that as a vehicle to perhaps just dig into that?
I mean, again, it's quite difficult here, because an awful lot depends upon... I mean, I will never proselytise. I never try and persuade anyone that God exists, because I simply don't think you can do that, because I think you've got to start from an idea of God that you have. And if you have an idea of God with the compasses and, you know, some sort of chap with a big white beard and so on, you're never going to understand what I'm saying. But I think that when I look at the nature of love, truth, justice, peace, all these things, when I look at our desire to strive for these things, our ideals that we fall short of more often than not, but that we still strive for them, God to me is the embodiment, which is not a good word, of all those values. So that's what God is to me. So that's how I give him properties, if you like. I don't know if that will not help you, maybe.
But when you say that you believe that God created us, do you have a view as to where along the evolutionary timeline you personally believe that might have happened?
Well, I think there were certain conditions that were necessary before we could have had minds, and so it must have been quite late in the evolutionary timescale. I mean, we had to have large brains, etc. I mean, I don't think for one minute that it's not the case that the way our brains are is a necessary condition for our minds being the way they are. I think it is. It obviously is. One behind.
Do you consider God to be a mind in the same way that we are minds? Your dualism, in inverted commas, was mentioned earlier. But if you don't consider God to be a mind in the same way as we are, then perhaps there's more of a triad there. Do you consider him to be different from us in terms of that mental substance?
No, I think, you see, if you, the way I think of our mind is not located in space. I mean, we tend to think, if we're not corrupted by philosophy, that our mind is inside the head. Okay, and that's because our brain is inside. Your brain. Okay, well, try and put aside any corruption. Our brain is inside our head, no doubt about it. I don't believe that our mind is inside our head. I don't think mental states like beliefs are spatially located at all, in the way that physical objects are. And here's one of the reasons I don't think that our mind is located inside our head. Here's a lady down here with a very nice fuchsia scarf. Do you think I could have a belief about that woman if she didn't exist at all? A belief about her if she didn't exist? No, hang on, think about this. I could have a belief of about somebody who looked very like her, but could it be, all right, think of your spouse. Could you have a belief about your spouse if that person didn't exist at all?
We believe about fictional characters, though.
Fictional characters, okay, you believe Hamlet exists or something like that. But do you not... Hamlet is a descriptive belief, isn't it? I mean, you could give me a whole load of descriptions about Hamlet. I could give you a whole load of descriptions about your wife or your mother or somebody. But that wouldn't actually capture the fact that she is who she is, uniquely herself. And if you married one person and made vows with that one person, swapping that with somebody who is qualitatively identical wouldn't quite do it. So if you think that's the person I married when you've swapped it for the doppelganger, that would be false, wouldn't it? So you couldn't... who the person is actually determines what the belief is about. So my belief about this woman down here is a relationship between me and this person. In other words, my belief is not located inside my head. I'm not an internalist about mental states. I'm an externalist. I believe the content of our belief is determined by the world around us. And for that reason, our belief's not located inside our head. I don't think God is located in space or time any more than our own minds are.
Do you think they're the same thing, though?
Sorry?
Do you think they're the same thing, though? I have very little evidence about the existence of you because I study philosophy, and unfortunately I have those kinds of things imprinted on my brain. I do have a good idea that perhaps I exist. That's probably the most certain thing I can be, the most certain I can be about anything. But God, if you're saying that God is kind of the same sort of thing as us in terms of a mind, well then... the question of whether I exist or whether you exist is the same as the question of whether God exists.
It's certainly true that just as I have to make a philosophical argument for your existence, whereas I have a personal experience argument for my existence, I need a philosophical argument for God's existence.
Do you think it's the same argument?
Yeah. Well, not quite, no, but similar.
What's the difference then? What's the difference between God's existence and my existence?
Between God's existence and your existence,
yes, in terms of
you are God. Your mind is located in the sense that it has a source. It's still spread over the world, but your mind is realised in your brain, whereas God doesn't have a brain in which his mind is realised.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
Just because, I mean, you'd acknowledge I don't know, maybe. I should ask you, just for clarification. I mean, there are things which are not physically located, but we don't have to go for some kind of substance dualism in order to accommodate them. So, for example, inflation. I mean, you know, you wouldn't say inflation's just north of Paris, or I've just trodden on it, or, you know, it's just not that kind of thing. But that doesn't mean that inflation exists on some other plane, is some other kind of substantive thing.
No, it just means numbers are not located in time and space.
Yeah, but you can get kind of platonic about numbers, whereas inflation.
You were going on and on and on about this person who doesn't exist in time and space, as if something that doesn't exist in time and space.
No, I think there are
things. Nonsensical.
No, I think there can be things that don't exist. I mean, actually, inflation exists in time. But it doesn't exist.
Well, mine
exists
in time, actually.
What I said was, I'm not sure I can make sense of the idea of a person who exists atemporally and aspatially outside of time and space. I really struggle to make sense of the idea, given that the concept person comes with various other concepts, like concept of agency, the concept of belief, the concept of desire, belief, desire, explanation, and so on. These are all part of, built into our concept of a person. And very many of these concepts are essentially temporal concepts. You cannot take the temporality away
and
still have a grip on the thing you're supposed to be thinking about.
And
so when you say there is a person who exists outside of time and space, I'm just not sure I can make sense of that. Maybe it makes sense. I don't want to commit myself here. I don't want to say it definitely doesn't make sense. But look, I'm not entirely sure that it does. I think if we do some conceptual engineering, we might discover that what we thought made sense doesn't really make sense. That does happen sometimes. People think they've really got hold of the idea of something, and yet it all starts to fall apart. The idea of Barthes idealism, I think, conceptually falls apart quite quickly. So we can, and yet you can have a room of people debating it. So just because something is there to be debated doesn't mean it makes sense. And indeed, it could subsequently turn out after a bit of hard thinking, but it doesn't. And
this is a possibility. It's presumably debated at length in the Middle Ages.
Phlogiston, yeah, well.
And it doesn't exist.
Can I take
back what I said about the mind not existing in time? It does exist in time, of course. Beliefs take place in time. It's just space that. There are no spatial relations between beliefs. I did say to the barman, actually, and therefore we'd better stick to it. We'll have a quarter of an hour, which we've used the first 5 minutes, quarter of an hour break, and then come back and you can lay into it again at length.
You've got the energy.
I think that was back. prove the non-existence of two things you don't believe in. Very difficult to do.
I did a whole talk and I was arguing about this before. I wouldn't put back this because I have a belief about somebody that's outside my head, therefore my belief is outside my head. But I mean, by the same token, I have a photograph of somebody who is outside my wallet, but my photograph is inside my head, so why should I assume that my belief is
really a photograph of Fred, actually. It's exactly the same. You know, it could be a photograph of Fred, but no, it has to be that photograph.
Sorry about the slight lack of audio at the start there. Marianne Todd has started wandering around the stage and it seems as if it cuts out the mic unless it's got a really clear signal. So, and then I switched to the emergency web stream, but that was coming from a mic on my headset, so you probably just heard me breathing a lot for a while. So I switched the mic over and it seems to work okay, so I hope that's fine. Yeah.
Church. Not to grab a prize for a church.
incarnation, yes. So that was kind of not normally considered an
option. No, that's what I'm saying exactly. Yes, I'm saying exactly. It is an option.
No.
To me,
yes.
It's central.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry because
I don't know. I really don't want to.
Did you want people? No, it's fine. I'm just waiting. Hello.
Are these all the questions?
No, it's just me.
Hello, Second Lifers. If you'd like to ask a question while we're having another 5 minutes break, then do by all means. And I'm sure I could get Stephen to join in if you'd like. Tell me if somebody.
Oh, sorry. Is there an official recording? Are you making one?
This is recording. What the quality will be like, I don't know.
We've got a Hillsong recording as well.
Oh, okay. Because my companions have decided they hunger is getting the better of them. So.
Yeah, well, we'll do something with that. And it should come out fine.
Okay.
Should be. I can't guarantee
it. Yeah. And that was crushed by the Catholic Church. And with the help of the VCM, we kind of did what we were talking about. It's actually
The idea is.
I'm studying consciousness studies with a teacher of mine, Alan Wallace. He's very famous.
Okay. I know that name.
He's a philosophical translator of Dalai Lama.
Philosophical what? Sorry.
Translated. His name is Dalai Lama in America.
Okay.
And he's got the Institute for Consciousness Studies in Santa Barbara.
Very old time, it's more presumptuous than any religion, actually, because at least they came to a whole bunch of where these guys, they just write, we believe in this point. And it's just like hearsay, isn't it? They claim they back out of all kinds of things.
Well, you should be reading
it. Correlation.
The idea that there will be a wisdom view on,
it's not a whole lot of real science to touch.
But
people don't really realize what it is.
Well, that's enough.
Otherwise, there wouldn't be so many souls from it. If they really knew what they're doing, they will have to look to somebody. They will look to scientific materialism. That will give them nothing. Because it doesn't give anything.
Because there's so much hotter and hotter
Lens. Well, I'm kind of.
Maybe they could define atheism for a
bit.
Well,
but then attached to that,
the first fringe events.
Well, you're right. There are actually two definitions, maybe. So
that's
right. One which then, which really comes down as a form of non-committal sort of agnosticism.
Yeah. What did you read to?
But actually, of course, nowadays, hardly anyone means that way. It's not specifically
disbelief. Yeah.
Even you make no difference.
Disbelief.
We're talking down to
it doesn't mean they're materialistic. It means there is just a material world. There isn't a supernatural realm or supernatural beings. There is just a material world. That's what making them materialistic. It's not money grubbing.
But it's the dollar that came from the 17th century. That's
So the word materialism means two different things. It means selfish grasping and wanting material possessions. But it also means, it's also a philosophical question, there is only ultimately the material.
John's written.
So when people talk about scientific materialism, they mean the there's a material universe. The scientific method is
you must have quantum mechanics in it or something like
that. Our best way of finding out about what the material universe is like.
But that's science.
Yeah.
I mean, science. I don't understand.
The scientific materialism is there's only a material universe, and science is our best way of finding out what the material universe is like.
Always been around it. I mean, the first man who said there cannot be eclipses all over the world, that was being scientific.
A religion involves denying the truth of scientific.
No, I'm just talking about this particular world of scientific material. He was being scientific. The whole committee was against him. He had to run for his life. And he proved it.
Yeah.
He proved it by charging and saying, did you see an eclipse?
Yes.
Did you see any? And then he marked a circle around and he said, the moon must be at least this size.
Yeah.
He was way off by thousands of degrees. But
he was scientific. You can be scientific.
Do you understand what that means?
They're not religious scientists.
I know many.
You know what the scientific materials were the actual religion. The people in the tradition in the Enlightenment, the religious people had to become scientists.
It's a good question where I would like to know because for some people it's kind of an insult. It's a bit like is what it means. whereas some people find it
I think we must show this film by Bill Maher. I've got it. The best thing to see is that something we don't know.
Just because
you're talking here, four dimensions. Well, we probably have more than that. Similarly, information is understood maybe on the edges of the universe. You understand what I mean?
There's all sorts of stuff out there that we don't understand.
No, I mean, something we are very sure about, like,
you know
what?
Lecture room here, but this is the lecture room, and these are the people who are watching in the virtual world. Take a seat, because we're about to start again. Dave wanted to just show you your colleagues in Second Life. These are the people who are watching the debate in the virtual world. Are you, what? Oh, you're putting your hand up for a question while I'm waiting for you to get back.
Another level
Steve
of
stuff. He's so good at advertising. Well, I don't think I might ban you for doing that. Right, okay. Stephen wants to do an advertisement.
Yeah, if you're interested in Centre for Inquiry, the website's there, and also if you leave us your, we will keep this completely confidential. If you leave your email, I'll add you to our database, and then you can be updated about events that we're running, such as the Mary Warnock Simon Singh one. On the 25th. So if you're interested,
where is that?
That's going to be in central London at Conway Hall, which is right near Holborn Tube.
Yeah.
Right close to Holborn Tube. Red Lion Square. 25 Red Lion Square, right close to Holborn Tube. So I'll leave these down here. If you're interested, just stick your email address.
And this, www.philsoc.org.uk, is the web address for the Philosophical Society of the Department for Continuing Education. So if you'd be interested in any of the discussions they run, or if you join the society, you actually get a discount on weekends for the Oxford University's Continuing Education Department. And you'll also be able to get my email address there, so if there's anything that I've talked about tonight that you're unhappy with, you're most welcome to email me. I don't promise to answer. It depends what you ask. Well, only the sensible questions I'll always answer.
So if there are more questions, are we really going to go all the way to 10 o'clock?
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Well, unless okay. There aren't any questions, well, in which case we'll give up. Okay. Is this a second life?
If at any point you wish to stop, just jump off.
Okay, we'll have a second life question, right, then okay. Stephen, then Steve. Thank you. And then the young man behind you.
This is a question from Second Life. It's written kind of in the first person, so it might lose a little bit in translation. My problem with Marianne's idea that if we reject the idea of God, that we must be eliminativists. Is that the correct phrase?
Yep, well done.
But I don't understand the must. It seems to me that there are good ways of thinking about the mind in the absence of a belief in God that are not eliminative.
Mm.
It seems to me to be a straw man argument that if there is no God, that the brain is just a piece of meat that can't make a mind, and since there obviously is a mind, then there must be a God.
I got lost at the end there.
Well, go for the first bit.
Okay. Yes, of course, there's another explanation, and in fact I talked about the other explanation. If we can reduce truth, meaning, love, etc. to something that's visible to science, then we can explain all these things in a scientific way, probably natural selection. And God isn't necessary. I did actually say that earlier on. Of course, that's an alternative explanation. It's not one I believe. You perhaps do believe that one. I invite you to prove that you can reduce morality to the greatest happiness, the greatest number, or reduce meaning to syntax. And when you've done it, come and show me, and I'll say, well done, and we'll publish a paper together and make a fortune. Well, we'll do it if you like.
Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah.
What do you mean, thanks. I'll do it? We'll do it.
But aren't you, because you're saying the onus is on you to explain this, as if they can't, if they can't explain it, you've won.
Well, no, I have tried to reduce these things. I mean, I really have in my, obviously in a 1-hour session, There's no way I can go into all the arguments, all the background, is there? But I have tried very hard to reduce, in particular, the mind to syntax, semantics to syntax, meaning to grammar, if you like, rules of grammar. I found I couldn't do it. We also know that in the philosophical literature these days, there are people who are working all the time to reduce morality to utilitarianism, to the greatest happens to the greatest number. Fodor, etc., is slaving away to show that semantics is syntax. So it's not that I'm saying the onus is on you. What I'm saying is that actually there are lots of people trying to do it, and it has never actually yet, and it may succeed. I actually believe it won't succeed, but it may succeed. And if it does, I will say, good on you.
Right. So there's a gap. There's a gap in our understanding of things, and you're saying no one has filled this gap. No one has explained how.
No, it's not of the gaps.
Because it sounds a bit like one to me.
Yeah. No. Okay. It's the God of the gaps in this way. There is a gap in our understanding, but let's face it. Of course, there's a gap in our understanding. We all know there are gaps in our understanding.
Yeah.
This is not the personal incredulity argument that Dawkins throws so much scorn on. I'm not saying, oh my God, I don't see how to reduce syntax to semantics to syntax. Therefore, it must be God. I'm saying that the greatest minds in the philosophical world and also in various other places have tried to reduce semantics to syntax and have failed. I believe that there's a real reason for their failure, and what I believe is it can't be done. But I quite understand if you think it can be done. I tried myself for 20-odd years, and it took me a long time before I admitted defeat. But I did admit defeat. Maybe you haven't. I still think you should. but actually, no, I don't think you should. I think actually we should keep trying as much as we possibly can, because why not?
I agree that there are some great big philosophical problems, and that the nature of consciousness, for example, is one of them, and free will is one. Why is there anything at all is one.
Do you believe in free will?
I'm not sure. I know I could be a compatibilist. There are all sorts of positions. even if I did sign up to determinism. I mean, there's a huge range of different positions and options. I mean, I'm very partial to a sort of Wittgensteinian view about the mind. I'm not entirely sure it's correct, but it does not involve any commitment to Cartesian souls or anything remotely like that, or things existing non-temporally, ghosts in the machine or anything like that. But at the same time, it's not reductionist. It says, you know, you can't reduce minds to just physical behaviour or something going on in your brain. Indeed, from the Wittgensteinian point of view, it doesn't make sense to assign your thoughts a physical location. And yet, he's not going to be any kind of Cartesian dualist. So, he will agree with much of what you want to say, but he's not drawing the conclusion that you want to draw, which is, then the mind must be some strange, mysterious something.
No, I haven't said it's a strange, mysterious something.
Which exists, well, it's mysterious in the sense of
existing
outside
space.
It's temporal, but it's not. It's a non-spatial thing.
As you rightly pointed out, there are many things that are not located in
space.
Yeah,
but we don't think, I mean, inflation is not located in space, but we don't think of inflation as a sort of mysterious,
but I don't
in the
think
sense
the
of
mind
non-spatial
is
entity.
Necessarily a mysterious thing. I think that my belief about the lady with the, who's sadly gone, but I mean, that gives me the ideal example, which is that I'm now thinking of that lady. If she never did exist, then am I having a thought at all?
We never saw a lady.
Well, then am I having a thought at all? Because actually, if you do think that you can't have a thought about somebody if that person doesn't exist, then if you think you have a thought about somebody who doesn't exist, actually you're not having a thought at all.
Oh.
So there's a long... Oh no, you often think you have thoughts when you don't. I only have to think of my undergraduates to know that.
You
often think you have a thought when you don't.
No, you only have to think about what? You said you only have to think about...
My undergraduates, when I think about having thoughts, or thinking you have thoughts when you don't.
A very clever gentleman was mentioned photographs. Who was it? He's gone as well.
He was suggesting that the idea of you can photograph something that doesn't exist.
If that's what he meant, I completely misunderstood, because I thought he meant something else. I mean, the thing about a photograph of my mum is that unless it was actually taken of my mum, it is not a photograph of my mum. It is related to her, and it is an object dependent thing. It would not be that very photograph if my mother had not been in front of the lens when the picture was taken.
Yeah.
So photographs too, you see, have this very property, which leads you to suppose that thoughts aren't anywhere, and yet the photograph's in my pocket.
Oh, hang on, I'm not saying that there isn't something inside the head, but I'm just saying that what is inside the head isn't your belief, or your mind. Obviously, it seems obvious to me that you couldn't have a belief about somebody unless there was something going on in your brain. But what I'm saying is that it's not the case that what's going on in your brain is sufficient for your having a belief about that person, because that person must also exist. So in order to have a belief about that person, there must be not only your brain, but also that person.
But your belief could still be in your brain in the same way that the photograph is in my pocket. The relatedness...
part of your belief.
That doesn't follow from your point about the object dependence of the belief, because the photograph is object dependent too, and the photograph can be in my pocket. So why can't the belief be in your brain? The fact that it depends on a relation to some external object, such that it wouldn't be that belief or that photograph if it weren't, say, related.
There could be a photograph that was exactly like the photograph. It wouldn't be a photograph
exactly
of your mum.
Yeah.
Yes,
it too is dependent.
Yeah.
So this is an argument for driving the thought that thoughts aren't anywhere is not a good argument.
It's a thought that the aboutness relation isn't located in your mind.
Put it this way.
I believe with the Cartesian that it could be the case that everything is with you exactly as it is now, and yet the world be completely other than it is.
I don't think the object dependence thing doesn't get you thoughts aren't spatially located, because if it did, it would get you photographs aren't spatially located, which clearly doesn't follow. But there is another kind of consideration about, you know, the zombies.
Oh,
right?
God. Stephen loves this one, so I'm going to let him do this. God.
Well, but that's kind of what you're thinking about, isn't it? Even when you've got everything that's going on inside my head, you could have all of those physical facts in place, and yet there are still, it seems, further facts on top of those physical facts, is what you want to say. There's a quality to conscious experience. There are facts about conscious experience.
Except the zombie has nothing going on inside its head, does it?
Well, the thing about this, I'm running various things together in a way
you
I shouldn't
are,
hear.
I think
yeah, I'll do the zombie.
Do the zombie some other time.
Well, no, some people say, look, you can conceive of zombies. And we don't mean people that stumble around with their arms hanging off and drooling. We mean philosophical zombies. So a philosophical zombie is exactly like us, behaviourally and physically, but lacking conscious experience. It is conceivable that there could be such beings. And some people think that the fact that we can conceive of such beings, that there could be a planet of beings physically exactly like us and yet lacking consciousness, for example, shows that consciousness must really be something distinct from what's going on physically. They run a kind of conceivability argument based on this sort of zombie thought.
The idea is that the zombies behave exactly like us.
Yeah.
So
and I think maybe running, you were just about to, or you weren't even, oh, I just got the long end of the stick then. I wish I'd never mentioned zombies now.
So where in the body is love or morality located?
It is.
It is in the body.
Where is it?
Even Steve would deny that that's not
okay. I'd say it's a category mistake to attribute love as spatial. Where's inflation?
Morality isn't spatially located, like inflation.
Just because it's not spatially located doesn't mean we have to bring God and supernatural beings into the picture.
Nor does it mean it doesn't exist, because we mustn't model existence on the idea of a physical object. Just because you can't kick it or put it into your pocket doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
God with regard to morality, aren't we? God is love, God is morality, and God is abstract and outside the physical space of a human being. But why do we have to include that in the hypothesis of God's existence or non-existence?
Well, I do, but Stephen would deny that, and so would Richard Dawkins.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I mean.
You do.
So you, yes, I believe that, but that doesn't entail that I believe that morality must be located. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were thinking?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
No, morality isn't located in space either.
Get us back to the God thing. When you ask more liberal-minded, non-dogmatic religious people, like Marianne, what do you mean by when you say you believe there's a God, that's some kind of meaningful proposition? One category of answers that you get, it tends to be statements like, God is that towards which we strive. In conversation in the break, there was, God is the inevitable and underlying glue of human experience in the universe, and so on and so on. And I suppose my question is, what are these other than statements that are just reducible to human experience? In other words, why do you need to posit God in order to say things like, there is something towards which we strive? And that whole category of what we might call non-dogmatic.
Well, the way you put that, it makes it quite easy, because what I'm striving towards is not myself. I mean, if somebody did mention this to me, I'd just like to run a quick logic lesson here. Marianne believes God exists. The backward E just means God exists. There's an embedding sentence, an embedded sentence, okay? The truth of this is one thing, okay? And the truth of this is another thing. Mm. I mean, it could be that this is false and that's true. I mean, I'm perfectly, you know, as with any other belief I have, I'm quite prepared, Patrick Dawkins, to stand back and say, I believe God exists, but could I be wrong? Because otherwise, how would I ever test for my belief? It's also the case that that could be false and that could be true, which is what I think is the situation with Stephen. So God does exist, but it's not the case that Stephen believes God exists. Or they could both be false or they could both be true. I mean, the idea is, and you may question this on other grounds, that there's one fact that makes that sentence true, and that's a fact about me, that I believe God exists, and I've already said I quite accept that there are other explanations for my belief that God exists other than that God exists. You know, maybe I've been brought up that way, or, you know, da-da-da-da. But there's another fact that makes that true or false, and that is that God doesn't exist. Or you might think that that actually is incoherent, and that actually I don't have a belief here at all. Which is, I think, what Alan was getting at earlier. Sorry, did somebody...
Is this testable? Is the second bit testable? Do we have access to its truthfulness? Can we...
Well, the testable bit is what Dawkins was saying about, you know, is it a scientific fact? And both Stephen and I have agreed... Or Stephen said... Actually, Stephen's been more gung-ho than I have on it's not being a scientific fact.
Well, it might be scientifically accessible. It's possible. Dawkins' argument might be a good argument. I'm just saying you don't necessarily have to run scientific arguments in order to be able to refute it. And all of that assumes that there's something there to refute. And we might even question whether the very idea of there being a God makes sense. So
can I just make another point? Sorry, I was trying to make that before the break. Because my mind happens to be psychologically corrupted, I happen to be a psychiatrist, I just think that there might be another reason why my belief about somebody else might not be true, irrespective of their existence or not. And this is simply the fact that we as humans tend to project. So we might project good qualities, bad qualities, and actually I believe that relationships are based more on projections rather than on objective truth about the other person.
But anybody...
So it might be the case that we are all projecting good values and qualities about what we strive towards, as was, you know, pointed earlier. But this doesn't necessarily have it to do with the second bit of an argument, whether God exists or not, which might not be even accessible to us.
But that's exactly what I'm arguing. Mm-hmm. I'm arguing on the grounds of logic, nothing to do here with my belief in God, that there's one truth about whether Stephen believes P, whatever P is, whether it's a truth about his wife on whom he may be projecting all sorts of ghastlinesses, or a belief about he's got a kitten down his jumper. So there's one fact about that, and there's another fact about P. And it might be that the two truth values differ completely independently. On the whole, not always. I mean, if we put sardines are tasty in for P, they won't differ independently because truths about personal preferences actually are a function of what you believe. But on the face of it, if God exists, is coherent, if it's a coherent sentence and it's either true or false, then the fact that makes it true or false is going to be different from the fact that makes it true that Stephen believes it. So I'm completely agreeing with you. It's very important to keep separate those two things.
But you're avoiding the question now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Am I? I'm sorry.
The original question was, what is meant by God? It wasn't about the atomization of the statement.
Okay, but I was answering that question over there, which I think was more about this. Is that reasonable? Okay, well... If we go back to this one then, Marianne believes God exists. I believe that there exists a mind in time, but not in space, and that that mind is rational, is loving, embodies, which I said is the wrong word, truth, etc. Now, I know you disagree with that, but that's what I believe. And you can now show me that that is incoherent.
The question is if
Marianne believes squares are circular, okay, if Marianne believes squares are circular, you might say there is a fact about that, about Marianne's belief, but there's no fact that makes that, well, actually there's a fact that makes that false, isn't there?
Yeah.
That squares aren't circular. So in the same way, if God exists is incoherent in the way that the problem of evil suggests it is, then...
Well, there is a circular square. There's no fact that makes that true.
Yes.
Or false.
Yeah. No, it is a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah, so if you phrase it like that, and you can say, you don't need a fact to make it false. You just need to understand
I actually think you've misbelieved if you've believed a contradiction. You falsely believe you have a belief.
You could... Depends what you mean by belief. It just becomes a semantic
question.
It's a very
people at the back of... gentleman at the back... Jean, actually, I said you were first and then you. Okay, Jean, first.
This may be repeating what Steve was saying, but when you were pressed before about God, you talked about love, truth, justice, and peace, and your desire for them. Now, why can't you just have that? Why do you have to have God as well?
Because of my beliefs about what truth, love is, etc. I mean, going back to my belief that you can't reduce meaning, for example, to syntax. So, for example, science doesn't recognise reason. Science recognises cause.
Science doesn't recognise reason. Science is
based. Yes, actually. Scientists have to use reason to establish causes. But it's not their job to study reason. What they're trying to do is to reduce reason to cause.
There are two meanings of the word reason.
They use it to do the thing they're trying to prove it can't do.
So well, and I believe that's
so
actually one of the...
That?
You can scientifically study reason. I mean, you can compile statistics on how prone people are to certain fallacies, for example. It's very interesting. So, I mean, the study of reasoning and how people reason is certainly amenable to a scientific investigation.
But
I don't think that... You weren't denying that, were you?
No, I'm certainly not denying that.
No.
But what scientists are trying to do at the moment is to reduce reason to cause, because cause is something that science recognises. Reason, the rational relations between beliefs, consistency, entailment...
I understand all that, but we don't have to... I wasn't saying it should be science. I quite agree with you that there are realms that it's not science, it's something else. But I don't see why, if you have love, truth, justice, and peace, you have to have God.
But that's what I'm saying.
It doesn't have to be either God or science.
We're suggesting that there are all sorts of hypotheses. I mean, if we take truth, there are lots of different theories about what truth is, okay? And some of them will, if you like, reify truth, to make truth something that's something to strive towards and so on. And I'm afraid I'm that sort of person. I think truth is really something non-natural. I think truth is that God is needed to explain truth. Now, a lot of people in this room, and I'm absolutely sure Stephen would not think that about truth. Stephen would accept a different theory of truth.
Well, presumably accept a natural theory of truth. Well, I'm not necessarily, as an atheist, wedded to naturalism.
Okay.
Or materialism. I mean, this is one of the rather annoying things that happens in these debates, is that if you say you're an atheist, you are immediately, it's immediately assumed that you therefore are ideologically committed to scientific reductionism, naturalism, materialism, and all sorts of other isms. And of course you're not. All you're saying is there ain't no God. That's it. But what about truth?
I mean, what do you...
Well, I mean, I don't have a fully worked out theory of truth or consciousness or various other things.
I want to say something about truth.
Okay.
Truth is that you have an explanation of a phenomena from the phenomena itself.
Well, an explanation...
So
isn't.
You might have different explanations of something before,
it might
like
be
the
a
planetary
wrong explanation.
System. You could have epicycles and all that sort of thing. That was the truth. And now we have a different truth.
But can we go back?
The point here is that we find the explanation of the phenomena from within the phenomena itself. A scientist would never say that, oh, the divine thing made this thing, or the Large Hadron Collider is going to work by a divine intervention on this thing.
Well, of course it wouldn't.
If we are looking for a Higgs particle, we have to find the phenomena explanation from the phenomena itself.
No,
and
not
that
necessarily.
Is what truth is.
Actually, I mean, you could have...
I mean,
scientific
to say that truth is we have to strive towards... I mean...
You could have a... I mean, I consider various paranormal claims scientifically investigable. It seems to me that there could conceivably be a situation in which we have sufficient, you know, carefully amassed and sifted empirical evidence that it might be reasonable to suppose that there are disembodied minds. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that we're going to come up with such evidence, but I don't rule it out. I'm not ideologically committed,
no,
before
the
evidence
is
even looked at,
explain it,
to scientific materialism and the assumption that there's only the material world.
I don't exclude anything. I don't exclude ghosts and probability or not probability. But if you are going to explain it, you will have to come out with an explanation from within the phenomena. You're not going to say some divine being is sending these ghosts sometimes and taking them away. I mean, for example, there's a famous physicist who has written a book about Christianity, and he says, you know, Christ, he rose from the dead and on the third day or whatever it is. And how he explains this, you know, all the particles and anti-particles came together and this thing happened. Bizarre, totally bizarre. So to strive toward truth, I mean, I don't know, I'm just striving towards truth.
But that's the explanation,
yes.
That you don't believe.
Okay, but
you
let's, the
truth.
Young gentleman at the back had a question.
It's impossible.
Well,
he's
been waiting
particles
for
and 10
minutes,
particles coming
so
in.
Let's let him in.
Yes, chap, yes.
Mr. Law,
yes.
During about the first quarter
Mr.
of
Law,
your introduction,
yes.
You made the comment about Dawkins' God hypothesis that you were going to flesh it out, I think is the phrase you used.
I added it to it, yes.
Well, you did. And from that addition, you then added the evidential argument of good and evil. Which are both, I accept, to be strong arguments. But why did you choose to flesh it out?
Because otherwise the argument doesn't
work. No, I accept that. But
yes.
Why didn't you... Where's your criticism for the God's hypothesis that Dawkins wrote?
Well, that would be a different argument.
I was going that this was a lecture on the God delusion.
Well, no, because... Dawkins is attacking the beliefs of those Christians and Jews and Muslims who...
And non-Christian Jews.
I suppose so, yeah. But he's attacking a certain kind of religious conception of God. And he doesn't add more to his initial hypothesis than he needs in order to make his argument work. But of course, all of those people are in fact almost invariably committed to many more claims, such as that this being is all-powerful and all-good and so on. So I mean, I can understand why Dawkins works with the most economical version of the God hypothesis, given the character of his argument, which doesn't depend on the being in question being good. But the fact is that the beliefs that he's attacking are the beliefs of people who nevertheless attach lots of further attributes to this being, and I pointed out that once you've attached those other attributes, you actually have a far better, it seems to me, argument against what they believe than Dawkins produces. That's not to say that I couldn't produce an argument also against that thin version of the God hypothesis. So, for example, my argument about does it even make sense to talk about a person outside of space and time. That argument does not require... That works just with the thin conception without adding any moral attributes to God or whatever. And it seems to me that that is also an extremely powerful argument. So we've got a number of different hypotheses on the table. There is an intelligence behind the universe. There's an intelligence that is all-powerful and all-good. There's an intelligence that's all-powerful and all evil, and there are various other possibilities too, of being two beings, one good and one evil, neither all powerful, which was at one time believed by rather a lot of people, actually, until it was suppressed by the Christian tradition. Some of these hypotheses, it seems to me, are a little bit more reasonable than others. I consider the evil, we have a scale of reasonableness, right, with, you know, different beliefs arranged on the scale in different positions. I'm going to stick the evil God hypothesis right down there. It's very low.
But the
idea that there's some intelligence behind the universe, I'm going to put it a little bit higher. It's not quite as silly as that. As far as the good God hypothesis is concerned, currently I'm putting it down with the pretty close to the evil God hypothesis. Maybe it's got a little bit more going for it. But I can't see it has very much going for it.
It's an argument against the evil God hypothesis. Sorry, I realise people are coming in and I've got my eye on who wants to come in. But
okay.
What would happen if you couldn't assume that most people, most of the time, tell the truth?
You couldn't have any right. Society would collapse.
Why?
Because you couldn't make any plans. And also because you need cooperation in most
I mean, the fact is, if I ask you, sir, what's on at the cinema, and you tell me, I've saved my time and energy. It's very useful. If I then think, oh, but I know what he's like, can't trust him, I've wasted my time and energy. Actually, the whole point of communication would disappear if we couldn't assume that most people tell the truth most of the time. Lying is parasitic upon truth in that I can't lie successfully to you unless you trust me. In fact, if I'm a dishonest person, I'm going to tell the truth most of the time because it's the best way to get you to trust me. The difference between an honest person and a dishonest person is that as a dishonest person, I'm holding myself ready to lie to you whenever it's going to benefit me. So, just as lying is parasitic upon the truth, I think there's no way that you could have an evil God. I think the good God is the only sensible hypothesis.
I mean, funny enough.
And it may be
false.
I leave that open. But yeah. But I think that if you're choosing between the evil God and the good God hypothesis, the good God hypothesis has got to be the one you go for.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about that very example that you've chosen is that I actually use it in the little paper that I've developed on the evil God hypothesis as an illustration of how you can defend the evil God hypothesis. Why is there honesty in the world? Because it's the price you have to pay for lying. Lying is not possible unless people mostly tell the truth. So this is actually what's known as you can make a distinction between first and second order evils and first and second order goods. And theists standardly want to say that the evils are first order evils that can be accounted for by second order goods. So why is there pain and suffering? Because it gives us the opportunity to do something which is not possible without pain and suffering, a second order good. And what you've just provided me with, fortunately, is an example of a first order good, which then allows for a second order evil. The evil God cannot have lying unless people usually tell the truth. That is the explanation for why they tell the truth, why you're out of it.
Okay, no, that's very clever. I like that. I'll have to think about that.
Okay.
Gentleman at the back there, you've had your hand up for a while.
All right. Marion, your original argument seemed to be, and forgive me for this, it's not true that all we have in our heads is physical states. Therefore, you cannot say there is no God.
No, I do think that all we have in our heads is physical states.
Okay.
But I don't think that our minds are in our heads.
You didn't mean literally. You didn't mean it literally.
Stephen, can you take her on? Just take on her argument, please.
Which bit? Which one?
Well, I stated it wrongly, so maybe you might want to.
I didn't like the one that Marianne was using was about the fact that thoughts are object dependent, and it looked as if we were getting an argument for the non-spatial locatedness of thoughts on the grounds that they bear this relation, and that argument doesn't work because it would apply to photographs too. However, I think Marianne's got better arguments, and she hinted at one, and then I caricatured it as being
as I do
as a sort of zombie type argument, but maybe you want to give us. Do you want to give us one, or would you like to?
Here's one. Okay. I mean, the Cartesian thought experiment. And I'm sorry, this is I sort of assume you wouldn't be here if you hadn't done a bit of philosophy. So, the Cartesian thought experiment suggests that it could be with us exactly as we take it to be, and yet the world be completely other than we take it to be. So. It's not just that you believe at the moment that you're sitting in a lecture room looking at two lecturers and the chairs are blue and da-da-da-da and you just had a drink and isn't it nice, but you could actually be asleep and you're going to wake up any minute and find that all the evidence is in for sitting in a lecture room, but it wasn't true. Okay, you had reason to believe it, but it wasn't true. The Cartesian experiment goes further than that because it questions what's absolutely fundamental to all of us, which is that the experiences we have are not only caused by something outside us, but they're also a good guide to the nature of what's outside us. So I have an experience as of a blue chair, therefore there's a cause of this experience, and that cause, what's more, is a blue chair. See what I mean? The demon questions those beliefs. I mean, how do I know? Because to believe that A causes B, you have to be able to see both A and B and to see that they're correlated. But we can't actually get outside our beliefs about the world to check that they're made true by the world. So although this is where we have to be to see that A causes B, or indeed that A resembles B, this is where we are with respect to our beliefs. Now, the Cartesian will claim that there's a great divide here in which there's a demon. That's not a pussycat, it's a demon. And once you've seen that your beliefs could be exactly as they are, although the world is completely other than you take it to be, you've then got to try and bridge that gap the whole time.
But has it ever happened?
Now, has what happened?
Anyone has ever found that the world outside what he pictures it to be is in fact completely different. Is there a scrap of evidence that this might happen?
In a trivial sense, it happens all the time. The sense that I'm talking about, you actually couldn't. This is not an empirical experimentation. This is a thought experiment, not an empirical experiment. Because the fact is, you as a scientist, you form beliefs about carbon nanotubes or something like that. But what makes your belief about carbon nanotubes true is carbon nanotubes, if there are any. But what I'm suggesting here is that the Cartesian will open up this gap between the way you picture the world and the world that you picture. And as an externalist, I don't want to open that gap. I don't believe there is any gap there.
No,
I think the world
has
could
anyone
not
ever proved
be.
That there is?
No, they couldn't. Not
exactly.
Not empirically.
Wait,
Stephen, go for it.
No, can
you just deal with this objection down here? Because he's not going to believe me, because you think it...
Well, look, you might... I mean... That you could be a disembodied brain floating in a glass vat with all of your experiences generated by a supercomputer. True, I'm not aware that this is actually true of anyone. But the point is that if it were true of you, there would be absolutely no way for you to tell. Everything would seem exactly the same. So the question then
is...
So
because you're invented by that.
So now we have two hypotheses, that it's a real world that you see out there, and that it's a computer-generated or evil demon-generated illusion. How do you know which of these two hypotheses is true? It seems you can't know, because the evidence is completely neutral between the two. Everything would seem exactly the same either way. So how can you know that one is true and the other one is false? It seems you can't. It seems we're forced to.
Which is the greater likelihood?
Neither.
Common sense
is true. Well, common sense, yes, but we're challenging common sense. That's the whole point here. How do you know that common sense is correct? And supposing it's a real world,
rather isn't. We know that.
Well, there you go. You're making my case for me. So, but now where does God? We nearly got to the God bit.
I've lost my track actually.
Is God going to come in and help
we're
us?
Talking about internalism versus externalism. I have lost my track. What did you ask me? Tell me exactly what you asked me. Can you do that?
I was asking. So we looked at one argument for why maybe your thoughts aren't physically located, and then
how
I said, "Have you got?
Have
you got
for...
another one?" And you started off, but then you got distracted.
Okay, I've got it. Okay, the reason I believe that that our minds are not inside our head is that I believe that whereas the Cartesian thinks that our beliefs could be exactly the beliefs they are, even though the world is completely different, okay, which would mean that your beliefs are determined by what goes on inside your head. If your head is that way, your beliefs are that way, whatever happens outside. I don't accept that. I think that the very nature of your thoughts is determined at least in part by what goes on outside, and that what that shows is that the nature of your thoughts is a function of your relationships, of how the world is, as well as how it is inside your head. Talking about your photograph in the pocket, something similar is true here. The photograph can be described almost completely in terms of its intrinsic relationships, but actually there's an aspect of the photograph, the description of which must appeal to something outside.
Yes.
And I'm saying the same thing is true of the mind, that you can't describe beliefs without appealing to what goes on outside.
Yes.
And we might be wrong about it.
So it's a bit like Putnam's.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's very like Putnam.
To deal with skepticism about the external world.
If I understand Putnam's attempt to deal with skepticism, I think it is.
Yeah. Okay, I've got it. Yeah. But Putnam's not going to go for your mind.
Well, Putnam might not.
No.
I mean, I quite accept that there are other explanations for these things. I mean, I do, obviously in believing in God, I'm taking on a very rich metaphysics that is not going to be desirable to anyone who isn't going to take on a God. I mean, my idea of truth, of meaning, of love, etc., is a very rich one, and far richer than anything Stephen would want, even if he's not going to reduce it. No, it's richer because it involves God.
Does that make it richer? I mean, first of all...
Oh, all right.
I mean,
if you don't like
possibly
richer, you can describe it in another way. We ought to let some people...
Yes. I don't like the idea that I'm living a half-baked,
I'm sorry,
slightly worthless existence, second-rate existence, because I don't believe in God.
No, but you have my ontology is richer. You have to admit that, because mine's got God in it.
So
yours hasn't.
I mean, if we just go for a richer ontology,
very.
Let's just introduce the entire...
Does every truth depend on God?
We could just introduce the entire Roman pantheon.
There are two people here who are very...
Can I go back to the God that you believe in, which I understand is a God that created our minds at some stage in what I see as the evolutionary history of our arrival in this position, at the same time didn't create the universe. And so it seems to be a very sort of local, Earth God.
No, he created any mind.
Is it not worth considering the scale of the universe? On 1 mile to 1 light year, when the orbit of the Earth round the Sun is then a circle 2 inches in diameter, and the Sun, 800,000 miles across, is a little pencil dot in the middle. The nearest star is 4.5 miles away, another pencil dot. The other 100,000 million stars in our galaxy are 100,000 million pencil dots on that scale, 100,000 miles across, because 100,000 light years across. And then there are all the other 100,000 million other galaxies.
Your
idea of a God. You get out of the problem of what on earth is the creator of all that doing with us on this earth, but you somehow manage to then say, well, it's all right. This God is just concerned with our minds. But then what? I've never heard anything so ridiculous as the idea. I really haven't.
Again, I don't think it's necessary to be rude.
No.
I'm not being rude about you. I'm being rude about your idea.
I'm sorry, you are.
A Popperian way, I'm being rude
about
your
idea. If you're being rude about my idea, you're being rude about me.
Let me answer your
point. I don't for one minute think that God is only concerned with our minds. If there is reason, if there are beings like us anywhere else in the universe, and with Dawkins, I go along with this, I think it's highly likely there are then I believe that God created them too. So I'm not parochial. I'm quite happy to.
Not the amoeba, not the chimpanzees, or not, you know, at some stage the brain becomes big enough, and then suddenly God created it. As far as I can see, what happens is when the brain becomes big enough, people are self-conscious, and then they invent God, which is what you've done.
Well, it's a view. You've got to back it up with that argument. I mean, it's true that I suppose when we thought that the universe was much smaller, and we were in the middle, and everything was going around us, it was kind of reassuring, you know, that we were the focal point of God's attention. But when you have, you know, a modern cosmology in which it's just, you know, enormous, and we're certainly not in the middle because there isn't one, then you might think, well, is it still possible to think of us as being the apple of God's eye? Well, actually, it still is, actually. I mean, it is. I mean, what's important from God's perspective is not how big things are, frankly. He's not impressed by distance.
But by us. By us here, you don't mean us humans, you mean us rational beings.
I was going to go for the humans. I mean, there could be no one else out there. It could just be us, and yet it could still be true. Because, you know, okay, it's a long way for us to travel. but you know, for God, it's not. So just pointing out how it's really, really big doesn't really, I don't think, undermine Marianne's position that even if it were, that we're special, you know, that seems to me that's still a perfectly reasonable position to take. Though I do take your point that it's a really, really big universe.
I am not denying it's a big universe, no, but nor am I denying there may be hundreds of other planets with things like us on them. Quite happy to accept that. This lady's had her hand up for a long time.
Poor old Marianne's been beaten up for a while now. Maybe she had some people critical of me.
I expected it.
Yeah, no, I thought it would be more even-handed.
Did you?
Yes.
What, after the God delusion? You must be joking.
Oh, yeah.
My question actually to you, because I spoke to Stephen.
You're going to beat me up again?
Yes, I'm going to beat you up.
There you go, you see.
Because I spoke to Stephen in the interval, and the reason is that I actually was a Catholic. I turned away from religion, A, because I found it incredibly sexist. It sort of took away free choice, and so many religions that actually control people, so you lose your free will, which we're all talking about. Mm. Why we're here is because of free will. And if I had total free will, I wouldn't be in Oxford. I'd be anywhere but Oxford.
But you could get on a train tonight.
It's quite difficult circumstances. Okay, but for living, and it's so difficult throughout your life. You have so many other things. Biology comes in the way. Environment of people, circumstances. We have so little, we have far less free will than we think we do.
Yes, I agree.
And, you know, like some people want to start their families in their 40s, which I think is a very good age for women, and yet fertility is starting to decrease, which is, as a social scientist, I would say it's the best time for women. And so many things are going against us, and I keep on thinking, is there God? Because do you know what I mean? Biology is working always against us.
Well, no, hang on. It isn't. Because any minute now, we're going to be able to freeze eggs. But the minute a baby girl is born, we'll be able to freeze her eggs. And at some point, whatever point she chooses, we'll be able to...
I know, because I did my dissertation on that, but I wasn't thinking about this.
So in 100 years' time, there will be no women facing a biological clock.
I know,
and that's
not
because
good,
creation
no. Yes,
is
good.
Partly our responsibility, I believe.
But we progress, but God hasn't progressed with us, we can say.
No, religion hasn't, maybe.
And I was doing, starting archaeology here, and studying about how we adapt to our circumstances, how animals, you know, just doing a few modules here, change to their circumstances too, but we haven't adapted to our...
Oh, how can you say that?
Well, no, not certain things haven't kept up with nature.
Like Catholicism?
Well, no, that and our circumstances and biology hasn't kept up.
But technology has.
Yeah, technology has.
We can do the most incredible things now. That and in 100 years' time, our biology is going to look completely different because of the technology that will enable us to interrupt what 100 years ago appears to be.
Stopping
and they are, and they're quite willing to do so. Sometimes they're right. I mean, I think there are arguments for example, I'm very unhappy about the views on the moral status of the embryo that doesn't accord it any moral status.
Yeah.
But I don't, as I said earlier, don't hold a brief for religion.
No.
But I don't think God has any objection whatsoever to things like freezing eggs and allowing women to become mothers whenever they like.
The sort of religion bashing in the book.
Somebody, John, you had a question about that.
Mine wasn't so much a question. It was perhaps more an observation. And that is that our discussion tonight has been perfectly brilliant and interesting, but it has actually focused on probably 10% of the book. The book itself ranges over a whole lot of other questions, like the behaviour of various churches, the history of what religion has and hasn't done, the claims of ethics and morality being driven by God or not. And one of his central arguments is that atheists ought to, as it were, come out of the closet and be prepared to talk and argue their case. Now, we haven't had time to really address the whole of the book, but I wanted perhaps to have the opportunity to say for Dawkins and on behalf of Dawkins that he said a lot of very interesting things which we haven't had time to discuss tonight.
Yeah.
Some of those things I have a lot of respect for.
I'd like to say a little something about that, and that is that one of his stated I think the book is appallingly argued in places. I think Dawkins goes way over the top, but he states right at the beginning that his aim is to give atheists, and in particular atheists in fundamentalist America, permission to be atheists. And I completely accept that aim. I too would like to give him permission to be atheists, and if the writing of the God delusion is what does it, then I'm jolly glad he wrote the God delusion. I just wish he hadn't given atheists in every other place permission to be rude to people who believe in God. I do think that's a shame. But I think an awful lot of what he says about religion is true, and I in particular think it. Some people need permission to be atheists, and I think that's a very good
thing. Are religious people not rude to those who don't believe in God?
Oh, some of them are. No, well, look at Dawkins.
They were a very long time.
Yes, it's true. Men and women have been very one-sided for a very long time. I think when women start putting men down now, I get a bit irritated because I think actually it's not the fault of these boys
that women were put down. To do a complete reversal before some kind of balance is reached.
Yeah.
So maybe it's the turn of the atheist to be slightly more.
Yes, perhaps so.
In order to eventually get to a balance, possibly. I don't know.
Possibly so.
I do.
Oh, it's a very dangerous idea. For us with nuclear weapons and things and jihad and all the rest of it.
Mm.
We can try and reduce the ubiquity of the belief in God.
I do.
We'll be a lot safer.
The other thing about religion is there are people who take religious ideas and who turn them into something abhorrent. I mean, jihad, things like that. I mean, it's one of the reasons I expressly said I hold no brief for any religion.
What I get uncomfortable about is the Teflon coating of atheism and religion. It happens both ways. If you say to a religious person, look at this terrible thing that these religious people have done, sometimes you'll get the response, but they're not really Christians. Real Christians wouldn't do that. As a way of kind of immunising the belief system from the outcome. But the truth is that atheists do it too, actually. I mean, in response people say, but what about Stalin?
And what about, no, they were really, in a way, they were really religious. Is the response that you get.
That's
yeah,
that's
they weren't. Hitler was, maybe, but Stalin certainly wasn't. And it's, I find it kind of embarrassing, because I want to be able to say, you know, no Teflon coating, period. I certainly am not happy when the religious do it, but I get embarrassed by atheists that do it too.
I don't see bad things being done in the name of atheism. They were perhaps in communism, but I don't see them being done in the name of atheism or humanism. I just don't see that.
Well, atheism, things have been done in the name of atheism. Atheists are just as capable of doing bad stuff as anyone else. But I think that this is, I wrote another book, which is very good. Called The War.
Did you write it?
I did write it. The War for Children's Minds, in which I suggested that the battle between atheists and theists has caused so much smoke and heat and noise that actually we have lost sight of the more important battle, which cuts right across the divide between atheists and theists, and it's the divide between liberals and authoritarians. Yes. And you can get highly authoritarian religious people. No, I do not. There are highly religious authoritarians, brutal, but there are highly authoritarian atheists like Stalin, and then there are very liberal atheists like Richard Dawkins, who actually is, although he's constantly portrayed as Stalinesque, he really isn't. He wants people to make up their own minds. And then you can get religious liberals. I asked Professor Keith Ward, where are you on my graph here, Keith? And he said, top left-hand corner, I'm a liberal that's religious. And so you've got Richard Dawkins and Keith Ward on the same side when you're looking at the liberal authoritarian axis. But they don't even notice that because they're just too busy going at each other over the religion issue. I think that, you know, if you want to really protect us against totalitarianism and disgusting regimes, let's be liberal. I don't care whether you're religious or not, frankly, too much. But boy, I do care about being liberal, and we liberals should get together.
I put it slightly differently. I think we ought to be charitable. By charitable, that means if you say something I think is stupid, frankly, instead of thinking that's stupid, I'm going to ask, why are you saying it? Because you're not a stupid person, so give me your reasons and let's listen and let's interact as if we're both rational people.
We should be, yes, we should. But we shouldn't overlook the possibility that one or other of us, although we think we have good reasons,
once you've tried
we
this
don't.
Thing for a long time.
Yeah. Oh,
but
and
one
possibly,
should always be open to the possibility
I'm
that one
open
is
to it.
Oneself
it could be,
wrong.
Yeah, but it could be that, I mean, my view is, and this does sound insulting when you say it, but my view is that many religious people, they think they're being rational, but there is something causal. This is a distinction between reasons and causes. They think it's reasons. It's not, it's causes.
Yes,
that's really
I
working
that.
Back there. And they just don't understand what those causes are. It's like when you're dealing with somebody that's been hypnotized to think they're a teapot, and you say, but Bert, why do you think you're a teapot? And because Bert from his perspective, he doesn't remember being hypnotized. All he knows is he believes it. He just knows. And it's because most of our beliefs that are not gleaned, not inferred, tend to be perceptual. He might even think he can see is a teapot, and that he'd kind of be puzzled that you can't see it too. Why does Bert think he's a teapot? Because of causal mechanisms of which he is ignorant have been working behind the scenes to instill that belief in his head. He doesn't understand those mechanisms, and that kind of explanation, I do believe, is an important component, not the whole story, but that kind of explanation is going to be a large part of the explanation for why people are religious. They don't believe it because it's true or because they have good reasons. There are causal mechanisms operating back there.
No,
now you might say they're truth sensitive.
Let me just interrupt, because I completely agree with the causal mechanism thing.
Okay.
And in fact, do you remember I said, when I said Marianne believes in God, you know, what makes that true is a fact about me. And I quite accept that lots of people will put forward the possibility that the reason I believe in God is something of the sort
you
that...
You think you're a teapot.
That, yes, exactly, that yeah. I think I'm a teapot. of course, that is a hypothesis, and I wouldn't be a good philosopher, I think, if I hadn't considered that possibility. Right. And to
so
the best of my ability, trying to put it on one side.
So you don't think
what
I'm being rude
it?
By
well,
using that as...
I'd be rude. I think you'd be being rude if you dismissed anything I said without considering the possibility that I had already
that
thought of that and considered it.
Definitely.
And therefore, I mean, as Stephen and I do engage in this discussion privately, and we are both very good, I hope, at giving each other. He does. He can be quite rude sometimes, but I'm robust enough.
I shouldn't.
But the fact is, you know, he's an intelligent man. He believes something false. let me put that slightly differently. He believes something I believe to be false. Therefore, I could just dismiss him as, you know, obviously wrong on this, it's causal mechanism, etc. Or I could say why. And he could do the same with me. And the thing is, if we dismiss each other as mad, we wouldn't have the conversation. And we wouldn't be learning from each other. And I've learnt an awful lot about my beliefs. I haven't changed my beliefs, but I've learnt an awful lot about them from Stephen. And perhaps the same is true for you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And that's the principle of charity, or as you were putting it, the principle of liberality.
Yes, let's all be liberal.
Phil, you've had your hand up for about 100 years now.
Yeah, I'd like to return to the question of truth, because it seemed to me that Marianne almost had it right, but not quite.
Oh!
Because in the analytical philosophical tradition, you have the idea that truth values are assigned to statements or propositions. But in the philosopher Hegel, who I'm very interested in, truth is not primarily located in that region. It's primarily located ontologically in things and relations. Now, if you help yourself to that idea, the theism becomes much more plausible because, you know, if you help yourself to that idea, no longer do we have this projectionist idea that, you know, it's obvious that God is a projection from human beings, because we start to realise that the majority, you know, that in the universe, the majority of reality is outside our consciousness. If the majority of reality is outside of our consciousness, then to assign truth, to locate truth in the things that we say to each other, you know, becomes very problematic. So, you know, I'd like to hear the response to that.
Well, so we can't assign truth to anything we've said. I mean, that would apply just as much to Marianne as to me.
No, but there is some truth in that region, but the majority of truth is outside that region.
Oh, well, yes, now that you can say, look, in a Spinozistic vein, you can say, you know, the access we have to reality is so tiny, through a tiny stick, and there's so much out there, you know, who can say what's beyond this little tiny bit of which we get a glimpse? And that's true, but we can still be jolly clear that there ain't no evil God in it.
Or a good one.
Just making my Sherlock Holmes point again. There is this image which is very popular with theists, and even some atheists, because I've heard Philip Pullman use exactly that analogy. You know, there's this tiny little glimpse of which, and who knows what's beyond it. It's true, but it doesn't mean that you can't be pretty, you can have, you know, even if you can't be sure what is in it, you can be pretty sure that there ain't no goblins in it, there ain't no fairies, there ain't no Santa, there ain't no evil God. Draw your own conclusions about the other ones.
Yeah, but then evil is semantically located, isn't it? So, I mean, if we're going to assume from the outset that all truth is semantically located, then your argument holds.
What do you mean by semantically located?
Well,
that, you know, if Stephen gives a definition of evil, that we all have to hold by that definition.
No, you don't.
Well, okay, so in that case, we don't know what evil is.
Right, so we don't know anything.
Well, no, but we, if Stephen gives a definition of evil and then expresses a belief of his that involves evil, you know how to understand that belief because he's given you his definition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. You may disagree with the definition, but that's that's a different argument.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. I mean, the truth, you know, I'm arguing that truth is located outside the truth values that we allocate to propositions.
Well, of course it is, because the truth values are based on the truth.
Isn't that a different, just a slightly odd way of saying there's what we believe and there's what's true, and they need to be the same thing?
Yeah, but that's absolutely crucial, isn't it?
Yes.
That's what all these little diagrams on the board were about.
I mean, we all agree about this, I'm pretty sure.
When we have, hold this up a second.
Yeah, but you still talk
Stephen
about
believes P and P.
Yes.
These are still propositions.
Yes, it's a proposition.
Okay, is
and
that...
he's questioning that, don't you understand
right.
it?
He's questioning whether there are any, or whether they're true,
what
or...
he wants to say,
me neither.
He's questioning that truth is confined to propositions.
Let him speak for himself.
Yeah, let him... I mean,
well, he's already said it.
Well, I mean, I can't explain Hegel's philosophy in 1 minute, but in Hegel, truth is ontologically located. It's not semantically located.
I have no idea what that means.
In the analytical philosophical tradition, truth is semantically located. Yeah, they are two completely different views about truth.
They may well be. But, you know, where do we go from there? I mean.
Well, I've said that theism is much more plausible if you hold Hegel's view rather than the analytical philosophical tradition's view.
But can you have untruth in your description of truth?
We've can got time untruth? For one more question, and I think
the problem is that you're making a series of assertions and then drawing a conclusion, but we haven't had any argument for any of them, and so we can only go, well, that's very interesting, but you know, why on earth should we suppose that that's true?
Yeah, I mean,
And of course, it's too much to expect because it's Hegel, right? It's too much to expect you to explain it. He can do it, so it's a lot to expect you to explain it in 5 minutes.
Well,
clearly.
I appreciate the.
We should do it in the bar, I think, is the.
Well, you know, what I will say is that people need to reflect upon their experiences and think about whether the analytical philosophical tradition's idea about truth. Is actually what they really understand by truth.
The thing is, the point, my argument doesn't depend on any scientific notice, any scientific theory at all, and the truth is it doesn't depend on any philosophical theory either. My version of the evidential argument from evil is completely neutral on theories of truth, whether it be Hegelian or which branch of philosophy you
wrong,
cite.
But it is.
It's just, I'm saying all, but your argument doesn't work on this particular Hegelian conception
neutral?
Of truth. I mean,
how
I have
can
no,
it be completely neutral?
It's not neutral, but it's neutral on technical philosophical positions. You can articulate it without appealing to any of them. It does not depend on the analytic tradition in order for it to work. Most people in this, everyone in this room understands it, even if they have not the faintest idea what the analytic tradition is.
That. Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, saying always you're just wedded to the analytic tradition, Stephen, and that's why you think it's a good argument when it's rubbish. I mean, it's just not true because most of the people in this room don't know what you're talking about, and yet they perfectly understand the argument, and many of them will appreciate it's a pretty good one. So, some of them,
that's sophistry.
Frank. Yeah, I was surprised that Dawkins supported the anthropic principle. I was even more astonished that you seem to support the anthropic principle as set out by him. Can you say why?
I think he's absolutely right. The argument that we are here and the earth is set up just for us and we wouldn't be here otherwise, therefore God must exist, is complete fact. Frankly, because we are here because the earth is set up for us, not the other way. Sorry, hang on, let me get this right.
We
evolved, do you know what I mean?
It is a big crap.
We evolved because this has all the things that we need to survive. If it hadn't, we wouldn't have evolved. So the fact that we're here and the Earth is fit for us is exactly what you'd expect. That's the anthropic principle, and I completely accept that.
But he seems to suggest that it was set up for us.
He does?
No.
Richard Dawkins does.
I think he does put that forward, but he puts it forward in order to knock it down. He doesn't hold that himself. He says that theists believe that this world fits us like a glove. Isn't that miraculous? Therefore, God. And he then says, no, it's not miraculous, because of course it does.
Yeah.
Because
we're
involved.
The puddle story from Douglas Adams.
Yes.
It's a very difficult story.
That's the...
I will reread it. He was putting it forward...
In order to knock it down.
We should stop, look, because I mean, character three.
We should stop, we're exhausted.
So thanks for having me. If you wouldn't mind leaving your email address if you want details, and then otherwise we'll be.
If you want email addresses, I'll probably get them from him.
Just leave them for everything. Christmas cards, everything. Yeah.
We'll send them Christmas cards.
No,
well done.
Thank you. Good. Yeah, well, you enjoyed that?
Nice.
Did you get wrong? I'm sorry.
No.
I suddenly realised.
I don't think you've underestimated that. I need to give you permission to be honest. And he's given them not to listen to any arguments.
Yeah.
Good to be here.
Good, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
To go off now.
Did you meet Steve?
I'll email you.
Okay, yeah, you do that. Okay.
There was some. I'll just email you.
You email.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Yeah, I'm just going to get
How did that go, Dave? Do you yeah, it was